Again, welcome back, everyone, especially those of you who are online and in a time zone which is almost 12 hours away from here. I'm very glad to have Philip Bond here, and I would like to thank him for accepting our invitation and trekking all the way from Bethesda to here. Philip Bond is an Associate Director for Data Science at the National Institutes of Health, as you can see. Prior to that, he was, I don't know why he did that. He comes here from San Diego. Would anyone come to Washington from San Diego? Different story. But he said there are lots of exciting things around here, Four Seasons including. Okay. There he was.
One time.
The Associate Chancellor for Innovation at the University of California, San Diego. And Philip has authored almost 350 publications, including five books. And one of his papers, I think, has almost 20,000-30,000 citations in the supporting database paper that he co-authored and pioneered. And he's been in this area for a long, long time. And Philip not only wears several hats, actually, he was also an entrepreneur at one time in his life. And so he was an entrepreneur, an academician. Now he's a federal government employee. So he's transitioned to several things. And he's going to give us his insight of how life turned out to be over the past three decades. Philip.
Well, thank you for that kind introduction. The way you described it, it looks like I'm really going downhill fast. But anyway, I guess, yeah, I'm just going to tell you a little about what's going on at the NIH that hopefully relates to this audience. I would encourage you to interrupt me and push back or yell out and complain or whatever you want to do as we go along. It looks like a fairly friendly group, so I can take that. So, or I should say that in case you care, the slides are actually on SlideShare and you can download them. I'm a big open access advocate, and I couldn't possibly not do this without having things online. So you heard a little about my background. Let me just say I did found one of the, or co-founded one of the PLOS journals, which explains in part my love of open access and my bias, I suppose you would argue. I have worked with ontologies for a while. I've worked quite a lot with the Gene Ontology. I was on their advisory group for a while. And as part of our work on the Protein Data Bank many years ago, Helen Berman and I and John Westbrook and Keith Wharton-Parr and Paula Fitzgerald and others developed, before anyone heard of ontologies in biology, we developed a pretty rigorous data representation, which still underpins the Protein Data Bank today. So, and I think if you would argue that it's successful, it's, I would say, one of its prime reasons for its success. So, at least I have some. I'm not speaking to you completely out of a void. I have had some background in areas that presumably interest you. So, of course, having said that, I'm going to tell you a huge amount of stuff that I'm doing, but I've only actually been there like 7 weeks, I think. When I was asking Francis Collins, who I report to directly, what's my job description, and his answer was, "You're to change the culture of the NIH." And I said, "Okay, what shall I do next week?" Some of my initial rantings about this can be found in a blog that I keep about what's going on here, and that's just a link to some of my vision I had before I started, in case you care about these things. But of course, even though I've only been there a short time, I've actually been thinking about most of the things I'm going to tell you for quite a long time. So I couldn't possibly do something without showing a molecule. So this is just to emphasize what, I guess, the motivators and the drivers for a lot of the reason you're here and why I'm here. And that is, of course, the rapid increase in the amount of data. And I'll say something about that more in a moment. But I think the other point to note about this, and this is just one illustration. I could have showed a million different slides for this, and you've probably seen them all. But these are protein molecules, and they're molecules from over the years, and they're actually drawn to scale. So the point being here is that what we're seeing in all areas of biology is not just numbers, it's complexity. And this complexity in this particular field is coming both in the fact that these are supermolecular machines, but also that the experimental techniques that are used to derive this information are, you know, becoming themselves much more complex. So there's a lot of what's called hybrid methods used to actually solve these kinds of structures now. So this is, you know, all just an illustration of why we're here. Another piece of the thing I like is not only why we're here, but what's happening today, but what's happening in the short term. And there are many ways of describing this as well. I actually like this one that estimates there'll be 5,000 gigabytes of data for every single person on the planet by the end of this decade. And that's what we should be planning for right now. And that, in terms of federal agencies, what we're, you know, effectively confronting. And I have to say that for my brief stint at the NIH, we're completely unprepared for it in many ways. And I'll try and illustrate that a little more as we go along. But of course, it also, out of adversity, there's also opportunity. So there are many things that could happen around this data. There are many, you know, estimates of what is coming down the pipe. And I actually just, I mean, some would argue, and I would go along with it, that we're at this sort of inflection point, that in this potential exponential growth, we're sort of this inflection point. And these folks from MIT, I mean, you may have seen this book. It's one of a number of this kind of genre of books. This is, you know, this is the next industrial revolution. And they would argue that we are on this cusp, and the evidence they show for it is that some things are happening much faster than anyone anticipated. So the idea of Google Car, the idea of processing in real time large amounts of sensor information to automatically drive a car, most people thought that would not happen in this shorter time, and yet it's quite clear that it works pretty well. There are other examples, of course. Ways I like particularly, because that's like real-time processing of social network data to define how you should drive through traffic. And you can, you know, digest all of that in real time. And that wouldn't be possible if it wasn't for all of the, you know, the Moore's Law and everything else that goes with it. But so the argument is that we're on, you know, we're at the bottom of this upward curve, and some really dramatic things are going to happen in the next few years. And we can, you know, no one's pushing back right yet, but we could debate that. I would say that, and so this was sort of appreciated a while back at the NIH, and in fact there was a working group formed that reported directly to the director of NIH to actually look at what needed to be done. And that actually then led to my appointment. It also led to an initiative that's called BD2K, which is the Big Data to Knowledge initiative that the NIH has going. And my budget for that this year is $25 million, and the next year it's $100 million, and the year after that it's $100 million. And this comes from the NIH Common Fund, so it's actually money taken away from all of the individual institutes and centers of the NIH, all 27 of them. And, you know, I have to convince them over a period of time that we're doing good things with this money and that they should keep on giving it. But for the time being, there's things to be done. And really, out of this working group report, there was sort of like four different sort of aspects. Facilitate, all fairly obvious at this coarse grain level, but you know, broad use, analysis tools, enhancing training, and establishing centers of excellence. That's what came out of this report. I'm actually looking at things a little differently from this, and I'll tell you about that in a minute. But that then led to a series of either grant processes that are either out the door or will very soon be out the door. So, for example, there is the notion of a data discovery index, where it will be an index of data sets, and I'll say more about that towards the end. That's currently under review, and so there will be a consortium that develops such an index. What I hope will come from that is the idea that this becomes not only a registration point for data sets, but also, in a sense, at some level, a Yelp for data sets, so that you'll be able to go there, you'll be able to see commentary on data sets if there is any such made. And you'll actually be able to add your own commentary to it, and you'll actually be able to see how frequently such metrics are very important here, how frequently such data sets are used. And that's all going to come out of the data discovery index. There are 6 to 8 data centers that potentially will be awarded. Those are currently under review, and those are they cover different areas ranging from centers that are, these are not domain specific, these are really more data specific. So they could focus on things such as compression, different types of what's the NIH calls data wrangling, which includes all types of analysis and so forth, and visualization and dissemination. And I'm already pretty keen, and I'll say it here, that this is not going to be a set of initiatives which I've seen way too much in the past from a number of funding agencies, where centers are formed and they take the money and they run and they do what they like. What we're going to see here is with a situation where we're actually going, there's going to be significant contributions towards a national infrastructure. And there are other, this isn't the only effort towards a national infrastructure. Such a thing is going on at the NSF and so forth. So I think it's very important that the agencies really communicate and think about working together on some of these things. And we could discuss that. Clearly training. When I left San Diego, not just in biomedical research, but in my role as in innovation, I was made aware that there were 4,500 jobs just in the San Diego region that could not be filled because there weren't the data scientists to fill them. UCSD and the surrounding institutions were not training people, enough people to do this. That's a pretty serious problem. And so there are RFAs out there to start to begin to address that situation, and there are actually grants under review already. There's a software index. There's a workshop about that in May. Why we're separating the data and the software is another. This predates my arrival. It wouldn't have happened if I'd have been there when this happened, but in any case. So it's the same idea. It's essentially an effort towards cataloging existing software that's out there and offering services around that software in terms of, you know, things like ratings and so forth. And then there's under development is what will become an RFA for a catalog of standards, which certainly pertains to this audience, presumably. And that's still under development. And that will then lead to a workshop and other things, which I would encourage you to keep an eye on and look out for. So I would say what I just told you is just the beginning. So activities that are already going on. So I've just been now making some early, for me at least, early observations, which are going to influence what happens going forward. And I want to tell you what they are and see what you think about them. So I would say one of my early observations is we don't actually know very much about the data we already have, let alone all this effort that's going into, you know, the big so-called big data initiatives. We don't know much about the data we already have. And I, as someone who maintained data source resources until about 2 months ago, you know, I can speak to this in terms of what the federal agencies actually asked us to do. I mean, basically what they want to know is they want to know, well, how many users do you have, where are they, and how much data gets downloaded, you know, every month. Well, that's not really saying much about really how the data is used. That's really a cursory thing. And here's an example that illustrates why we need to do more. In the top right-hand corner there is a graph of from the CDC, which shows accumulated cases of H1N1 during the pandemic of 2009. On the bottom, on these two graphs, are accesses to specific data objects. In this case, they happen to be structures within the PDB, but let's just call them data objects, and how they were accessed during that same period. And what you see is that there's some level of correlation. So it's not surprising that when something like this happens, people go to look at the data associated with these kinds of events. what was intriguing to me was whether this could actually be used as a leading indicator. In other words, if you look to because the way CDC reports, it's quite slow in getting all that data together and getting it out there. Could we see things above the noise that were reflective of what was happening in the community as it was happening? I mean, as far as I'm aware, most of the data sources, certainly in the biomedical sciences, don't even think about doing things like this. So we're not making good use of how our data is used, which to me is rather ironic because it strikes me that many companies almost make their living on actually understanding how people are using their data and their information. So another example, which is one I really liked, and I presented to the advisory board, some of the people who probably sit in this room periodically, that for the PDB of what we should be doing, and it was a simple thing. Is if, and it's exactly akin to what goes on at Amazon and Netflix, right? If there is a data object, let's call it a protein structure, if an IP address looks at a protein structure, and then the same IP address looks at data object B, A and B, and then that happens again and again, the chances are when the next user comes along, if they are looking at B, they probably should look at A because there's an association between them. No one, even though this is big business to many companies, it's not something we do in science at all that I'm aware of. I've said that. I've had pushback. People say to me, actually one instance is people have said, oh, we're actually doing this. But clearly there's not enough of analyzing. We don't have good metrics, and we're not doing good measurements on the data we already have. And this is critical when you start wanting to start looking at sustainability because, you know, if you don't know what you've got already, how are you going to figure out what you can sustain going forward? A question. I love it. Yes.
Brian Neiman, Semantic Community. Wednesday, NIST is starting a group on data science metrics to try to get a handle on this.
I'm sorry.
Wednesday, NIST is starting a new group on data science metrics to get a handle on this.
Yeah, I mean, there is activities now, too, within the NIH to try and do this. And I think, again, this would be a great opportunity for some of the agencies to get together and figure out and look at what they're actually both proposing to do. I mean, at the NIH, there's, and this is true everywhere, what's obviously happening is that there's a large number of data resources coming to the trough or back to the trough to be funded. And it's eating an increasing amount of the total R&D budget. And, you know, this, if you make some projections about what this means, it's fundamentally a very serious problem if it persists at its current rate. So, you know, the question then comes, well, what do you keep and what do you not keep? That's where these sorts of metrics become, you know, very important. So, yes. So it's great. I mean, I think we should all be looking this together and we should be approaching this sustainability problem together. There was actually a meeting about this just last Friday here in Washington. It was convened by the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. In some ways, it's a bit depressing that it takes an outside third-party foundation to bring the feds together to do this. Of course, I'm blaming myself now. I'm now one of them. Another thing I've noticed is even more amazing to me, is that there are all these directives now. So there's the OSTP directive for data sharing. So in some senses, this describes why we need to share data. I mean, it's obviously a good thing anyway. But what I've found in sort of poking around is there hasn't been enough thought about the how. How, you know, if there's suddenly these requirements that data generated by public money needs to be in the public domain, where's it going to go? Now, certainly there are a lot of data that fits into existing data resources, and, you know, those resources will just continue to grow. But there's a lot of things that don't actually fit into those criteria. What happens to that information if there's now a demand for it to be made available? It wasn't very thoughtful, I think, if I dare say, of the White House to essentially say, well, you've got to make the data available, but we're not giving you any more money to do this. It's got to come out of your existing budgets. So clearly, we've got some interesting aspects of this. So, you know, and this just sort of essentially says what I just described. And a lot of this I'm talking about is what I would call the long tail of science. It's all of that data that really doesn't quite fit anywhere but now needs to have a home. So one of the things we've been we're moving towards at the NIH that I've been pushing on is the idea of creating a data commons. This effectively is a sandbox. At its simplest incarnation, this would be a Dropbox for, it says NIH investigators, but there's already been some interest from the pharma industry in this, and I don't see why it should actually be restricted in that way. And it'll probably be in the cloud. We can argue all these definitions. And you can imagine all sorts of interesting things happening with this, all right? At its very simplest incarnation, it is nothing more than a Dropbox. But I think if for larger amounts of information, that the majority of lab bench scientists or lab scientists, myself included, would relish having this available because I don't have something like this available in my own institution or elsewhere. So that would be, you know, that would be at its very simplest incarnation. And of course, if this data has to be available, that's available. There's already a certain stick there, so you could actually apply that stick a little. So you can, in this drag and drop mode, you can actually request some provenance associated with that data, beyond, you know, typically what might be actually requested, say in Dropbox, which is really just access control. And then, so that's the next layer, and you can begin to add layers on top of this. So the thing that excites David Littman at NCBI and I about this is, you know, it becomes a sandbox so that people can begin to write applications on top of this. So a drag and drop might lead to, for an identified data type, it might lead to some level of validation or authentication of that data to see whether it conforms to an existing standard. And the level at which it does would then be written into a metadata file, which is available with in the commons with the data itself. And, of course, people can then look at that. And then some of that data will migrate up into existing resources kept at NCBI or elsewhere, but that would be the next step. And then, of course, the pipe dream is the idea that once all this data is sitting there, you can start looking, you can start munging it, looking for commonalities. So if you know about how the NIH operates, you know, it's essentially 27 different silos. And the data is kept very much independently. So, which doesn't actually make sense, particularly in this day and age of complex diseases, where you really want to, data in one institute has value in another. There's no question about that, around two different diseases, for example. So you can imagine a day when you have a set of researchers working and they're depositing some data in the commons, and it has a whole bunch of, it's about a set of genes that are overexpressed in some pulmonary disease. Well, over here in the National Cancer Institute, there's a group of investigators running a cohort of patient information where they see in prostate cancer, they see downregulation in a set of genes. Now, there's overlap within those two gene sets. And if this happens if this is prominent in these investigators' individual data streams, then maybe they should be made aware of each other that they've been looking at the same gene for different purposes. So this kind of automatic, you know, finding correlations between things could have value. It's a dream, okay? But I like to dream. To do all of this, you've got to have an associated business model. And we're working through different scenarios with Google, AWS and folks as to how, or beginning to at least, as to how this might be sustainable in the longer term and how big and how it could grow. Question?
Yes. I like what you're saying. What I have
so
to
do
learn
I.
is the word
No, I mean, I think, well, first of all, I think what you're going to see in there is a total mixed bag, all right? But I think what you can do is already a good number of the data types that will be kept in here would have ontologies associated with them. And that's what I meant by wanting to apply that ontology to what's actually put in there. So if you can then map what's in a data file to what the ontological description is and actually describe where there are inadequacies, that's useful information to someone who wants to come and look at that file, because that file will be already registered in the data catalog. So people will be able to look at that file and other related files, and if they see one of them of different data sets, but, you know, some relationship or some similarity, but they see one of them is conformant to this ontology, that's the one I would choose. That will then, the idea is that would then drive more use to ontologies, because if suddenly we now have data citations and suddenly it's seen that your competitor down the corridor is getting more data citations than you're getting because their data's in better shape, it will drive things in the right direction. Sorry, that was an awful lie. I started talking about reward systems and I haven't even got to that yet. But am I making sense? Right.
That will probably be more important than the Dropbox or the data that you're pouring into it.
Absolutely. And in fact, yeah, I mean, obviously all of this is dynamic, so the ontologies are going to grow as well. But you could, I mean, I hadn't even thought about this before until now, but it's another dream. You know, and I mean, there are efforts at automatic ontology recognition and building, right? But so you could imagine a whole set of data files that conform, that are a certain type, of which there is already an ontology, but repeatedly the same elements appear in these data, but they're not in the ontology. That would tell someone, hey, maybe we ought to improve the ontology.
That's what I was thinking.
I like it. I'll add it to my slide. I'll steal your idea. Okay.
May I interrupt? If anyone wants to ask a question, please use the microphone. Otherwise, people on the remote lines will not hear anything.
Okay, so the third observation I had is on day one at the NIH, I wrote a note to a few of the high-ranking individuals whose names I shall not mention. And so I've Googled, and I can't find anything that relates to an NIH plan for data sustainability. And they said, well, that's not surprising. We don't have one. this is a big thing. I've already harped on it to some extent, but this is really going to be an amazing driver. And I think sustaining things comes in different forms. Let me just give you a couple of examples. And I've got plenty of problems here, but I also have some solutions. All right. So one of the things that has happened to me is it's what I call the Google bus. Okay. So before I left San Diego, Google does not have an office in San Diego, but they have an office in Irvine. So what I found is over time, half of my lab ended up going to work every day on the Google bus. It could have been the Bourne Lab bus. I mean, it got to be ridiculous because I could not keep these people at the university. These are very good data scientists for the most part. And, you know, for some of them it was money, and, you know, there's no way that the university is ever going to compete with that. But for others, it was being identified as a scholar. And I would argue that the current traditional academic environment does not well recognize data scientists as scholars. And I think, you know, I speak with passion about this because many moons ago I was one of those people. And I think we actually got a pretty raw deal. And what's interesting in my role before I left as an administrator is that there was growing concern about this because, you know, partly because they care, but partly because it turns out more and more these are the people who are bringing in the indirect money into the university. So, you know, you don't want them leaving to go and work for Google, particularly, and the NIH doesn't want them to go and work for Google when, you know, unless we're doing something together, because we spent a lot of money training some of them, or many of them. So these are sort of issues of sustainability around people, which I think we really need to fess up with. And Dan Katz and I and others have been, and Ed Seidel, have been having discussions about how we might help address this situation. One of the ideas is, which will happen, I think, is to have a workshop where we bring in high-level university, people like vice chancellors of research, and really highlight to them the value that these people are bringing to the institution. And, you know, I think if this is done under the auspices of the federal agencies, these folks will actually show up. Other things I've noticed about, you know, related to data is that data is always treated equally, even though data actually has different levels of maturity. There's all sorts of different aspects to it. So these are issues. The way we review data resources at the NIH is suboptimal. I won't go into the reasons for that because that would take, that's a whole lecture in itself. But these are all things that need to be looked at. So these are just some problems. So what are the solutions to this around sustainability? Well, I think, first of all, right now the individual institutes fund these things, but a lot of this stuff should probably be done centrally, and there should be a central oversight, a standing review panel that looks at this and really tries to help foster best practices, because we don't, at least at the NIH, we don't quite often, that's not what happens. And it's not surprising if you think about the history of how many of these resources come about. It's essentially one or more investigators who are very passionate about some data. And over time, they keep building this data, building it, and sooner or later, other people want to access it and use it. So they just say, oh, let's write to the NSF and get a database grant. And quite often when they do that, what they actually put forth is something where the data part of it is really well done, but the data management part of it is often suboptimal. And there's not best practices that are put in place to address that issue. Another issue that just came up at this meeting last Friday, it was actually from Eric Green, who's the head of the Human Genome Institute, NIH, was the idea of using a 50% model. So what that means is you say, okay, we're going to give you this award to maintain your database. But when this award runs out in 3, 4, 5 years, we're only going to give you 50% of the money in the next round, assuming you're successful. So that means you've really got 3 or 4, 5 years to figure out a sustainability model, a business model, to maintain this data. I mean, this sounds harsh, but I would say these are the realities of the new world. So if you've got better ideas for sustaining this stuff, I'd love to hear them, because there's plenty of problems, but not that many ideas. There's various kinds of freemium models, bringing in foundations, interactions with the private sector, the role of institutional repositories and all of this, and so forth. So there are, the metric reporting, which we already touched on. So these are all, potential possibilities, and I'd be, I know it's not quite probably the focus of this meeting, but I think, if you want to work in ontologies, you want to have some data to build ontologies around. So it's worth thinking about. I already mentioned a bit about training, but it's clear that at least what goes on at the NIH is the training is rather spotty. So in other words, there are some things that are taught time and time again by different institutes, and there's large areas of data science where no one's teaching anything. And so we're looking to sort of at least address some of this. And one of the thoughts I've had, and it'd be lovely to do this as an interagency thing, because a lot of this is basic data science teaching, is to establish some training, one or more training centers, where people actually come and they do hands-on stuff for 2 or 3 weeks. In my world, the Cold Spring Harbor do these kinds of things, and they're very successful. Investigators go back. It's graduate student, postdocs, faculty, and they go back to their institutions and, they actually begin to apply what they learn at these heavy-duty hands-on courses. So that's just something we've been thinking about and we'll probably likely put into place. Reproducibility, of course, which ties into the idea of having standards and ontologies, this is a big thing now that's on, of course, everybody's mind. And it comes about because, you can go into the newspaper and you can read that it's been reported that 70+% of all seminal studies in cancer research are not reproducible. Well, if you're a congressman reading that in the newspaper in the morning and you're responsible for going to the Appropriations Committee to give NCI $4.5 billion a year, you say, why are we giving you money if you can't even reproduce what's going on there? So, you know, these things are going to come back to haunt us, I think. And, you know, so the idea of doing better with respect to reproducibility is, you know, important. And that's why, and along the lines of what we've been discussing, the idea of having good representation is important, but it's more than that. So these are these kind of things that come up. And I actually looked at this in my own lab. So I actually published a paper recently which said I cannot reproduce the work from my own lab. And I was proud to publish this paper, right, because I know that I am not alone. I mean, and it wasn't that I couldn't reproduce. It was that I could not reproduce easily. Right? And the truth of the matter is any graduate student who comes into a lab, when they try and pick up a piece of work that was done by a student that's already left, will testify, yes, this is not straightforward. I mean, you can argue that there's a learning piece to this, that, you know, but at the same time, it shouldn't be this difficult. And the question we asked ourselves is actually, how difficult is it? And so we quantified every step. So we took a piece of research that had data sets, software, scripts, you know, all of this. It was a purely in silico piece of work and a published paper. And then we gave it to people of different skill sets in this field and asked them to reproduce the work. And, of course, you know, it's the old story. Four authors on a paper, two have left the lab, including the first author who did most of the work. You know, you call her up and she says, well, I think that, yeah, you'll find those scripts. It's still sitting on that computer in the corner of the room. You know, this is it. This is what we're doing. This is life, right? And then, you know, and then they ask me, and of course I'm the PI on the thing. You know, I haven't the faintest idea where anything is. I mean, it's, you know. So it took, this is just the experiment, you can read about it. It was done by putting this into a workflow system in collaboration with Daniel Garrigo, who's actually was working for Elsevier at the time. And it's terrible. Yolanda Gill from USC. And we used her workflow system. And this, I won't go into it. What was interesting in doing all of this, what automatically falls out of this, is a figure which I would call should be figure one in the materials and methods section of almost any paper, right? Because it actually describes in one pictorial exactly what the experiment did. And, you know, this is, to me, this is stuff that should happen routinely. It took 280 hours for, someone who was knowledgeable but not an expert to actually reproduce this piece of work, which seems to me, you know, we could do much better. We broke down where all the bottlenecks were. Anyway, we should be doing better. So I would say what I've told you is a whole set of issues, but what are the solutions? And I've sort of, in my head at least, I cast this solution into what I call the digital enterprise. Any institution is a candidate to be a digital enterprise. Some already are, I suppose. I haven't actually come across any who would seem to fill that to my satisfaction anyway. But so what does that mean? Well, first of all, essentially everything we do in certainly an academic institution or at the NIH or the NSF at some point now is in digital form. So that forms a set of digital assets. And if you think about what that's like in a medical center setting, for example, you've got data sets, papers, software, lab notes, and you've also got educational materials and everything else. And you could argue that at some point, you know, publishing of that material is really just changing access control. Okay, there's review as well, but you know. And then, of course, the idea is that digital assets are interoperable across the enterprise. So I made up, this was actually published a little while ago, and I actually have another one I made up for the NIH, but don't expect you to read all this. If you care, you could look at it. But I just want to illustrate a point. That was a point I was making at UCSD before I left, and it's a point that I'm now making at NIH, and on a different scale. 30 times the scale, I guess, if you want to talk about research dollars in billions. But really, what there is advantages potentially to be had in this, because what exists right now is silos. So you could say all of the any educational materials that an institution has and that are online are essentially siloed from everything else. The research data is all over the place, but it's certainly siloed. It's siloed from each other, but it's also siloed from the other forms of data. The administrative data, where all the grants are kept, all everything that's going on, that's a separate silo. And then if you're a medical center, all the clinical data is yet another silo. So if just some very simple interoperations between those silos can buy you so much. So I just sit there on a rainy Sunday afternoon, which of course in San Diego was rarely, but now it happens to me every weekend, thinking about these things. So, these like little scenarios. So one of them I've just been working with students, one or two I feel like child prodigies. They're just amazing. And when I'm doing that, I'm thinking that they're coming as undergraduates to universities and taking courses. And increasingly, those courses are online, and they get graded automatically online. So if I have a student who's exceptional in a piece of the course, a professor who teaches or does research around that area that's in the course, unless he or she is the one teaching that course, they will never discover that student. It's like light years away. But why shouldn't that happen automatically? All it requires is the fact that this student did very well to be identified and to have a decent profile, which, by the way, we don't have in almost – it's changing now. We don't have almost in any university for those people. What we have – if I wanted to find out what people were doing at UCSD, I would Google them. Well, that doesn't tell me – that doesn't give me an in-depth view of what that person does. And so I would make that connection. Then that – professor would then approach that student and say, hey, you did really well on this. You want to come and do an internship in my lab? And then there's a whole scenario about, and they end up winning Nobel Prizes and all that kind of stuff. But, you get the idea, right? And those kinds of connections, we should be making them every day, and we don't. Yeah.
Is there not a problem with privacy of linking all of these sources? In that example where, you were looking at it from the perspective of the good, finding the correct students, but I could imagine that you could do like the other way around of determining the very bad student like to be axed from the courses or the one that you're not paying attention
to. Well, that's kind of what we do all the time anyway, isn't it? I mean, but you're right. There are these sorts of concerns. But, in this particular instance, you don't actually, for example, have to reveal to the professor who the student is. You could, for example, the student could be the one to take the impetus saying, because essentially the professor is that information is already known. And if but most students are not going to be concerned that they reveal that they did extremely well in a course. But it's true when they do badly. And there are these kinds of downsides obviously exist in any data type you talk about. You start getting into clinical data, you're in a whole different you're into the issues you're raising in droves. But I think you have to sort of take every data type and every situation as it comes and figure out how to manage it. In some cases, you have to figure out how to regulate it because you probably won't be able to manage it because the technology will just run away with it. But anyway, we can talk about that. Here's just another example from the NIH sort of, and I won't bore it. So I guess where I'm looking, yeah. Yes, sorry, you have to use the mic.
Just to add to your point, Harvard has a framework called Harvard Research Profiles, which actually connects research scholars across the topics of interest when you just upload their profile into the institution framework, so you can automatically connect to your similar kind of research group. They don't exactly involve students, but they only, I think, involves the professors or associate faculty.
No, I mean, these systems are beginning. There are others as well, and that's a good one. We've been experimenting with these before I left UCSD. So it's clear, and then I bring that. So then I'm thinking, well, okay, now I have, I'm in an institution where I have some sticks. So, you know, I can begin to use that. First of all, having a profile system, ultimately, its value is only going to be if the faculty member actively participates and keeps that as the master copy of their scholarly life, right? But to do that, you've got to incentivize them. So, you know, one way to incentivize them is that that's the system you use for promotion files. I mean, as you know, we spend an enormous amount of time cutting and pasting things into different formats to meet different criteria, you know. And I think what's happening with, is it SciCV that's going on at NIH and NSF and other places to standardize the bibliographic format, this is a wonderful development, and that needs to be pervasive within the university environment as well, so we create much more seamless interoperability against, sorry, I've hardly mentioned the word ontology at all, against, you know, standard ontologies for describing scholars.
Steve,
this is much more fun than me rambling on.
Steve Ray, CMU. I was reminded when the privacy question came up that I just on the 26th, which is what, 2 days ago, read a New York Times article about this startup called InBloom, which was building these linked profiles of students of the courses they took, $100 million spent on the company, crushed because of opposition of privacy concerns by parents. I mean, it was exactly the same vision you were talking about of being able to help students. So I think this privacy issue is indeed something we can't just
shove under the rug.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't have a good answer to that. What I would say is I would quote something like PCORI, which is actually a patient network that's effectively doing this, where they're trying to build patient large, you know, million patient cohorts to do clinical trial studies in ways that are much faster than studies that are currently done and much less expensive. And, you know, again, you run into this problem, but it's a question of balance. I mean, do people feel that this contributes to their healthcare in ways that it's worth, you know, at least taking that risk? And it's problematic. You know, I think each one of these is going to find its own balance. And
question: in your note, your vision here is there a notion of symmetry involved in information sharing among the parties?
Yeah, I do structural biology. Symmetry is my middle name. No. I mean, yes. That first of all.
Well, then, couldn't an asymmetry alleviate some of the security issues or the privacy issues?
Well, I think that was what I was alluding to before, where maybe you're thinking of something different. I'm not understanding you correctly. But the idea that, you know, the professor's profile is already public, so the student should be pointed to that professor, which they probably wouldn't know otherwise when they do well on that course. But the professor is not necessarily pointed to the student unless the student wants that to be released. Is that what you mean by asymmetry? Okay.
It may also be, you know, partly a cultural acclimation issue. I mean, what strikes me most about what you've described here is that it is a formalization of what happens informally at small colleges, right? Having gone to one, a tiny little college myself, it was routine to bright students or students who stood out in one area, the faculty talked. And they talked about what students were impressing them at the time, and faculty would approach students and say, hey, I'm doing this small seminar and I love it if you would take it. And or assist teaching something. This would happen all the time. And the students found that to be, you know, an immensely valuable part of their education and something that brought them to new areas. I see something like this. If you have this kind of opt-in capability from the student side, I think overwhelmingly once people got used to the idea, they would think.
I mean, I think, you know, opting in is, you know, it's going to apply in lots of different contexts. I mean, right now people opt into a clinical trial for a specific, generally speaking, for a specific purpose. But more and more patients are clearly willing to opt in, provided there's some, measure of de-identification, for that data to be used however the researchers think. And others won't. But, you're going to get way bigger and less expensive cohorts of patients than we have today for many different things. Economics is just going to drive all of this in the end, I think. But it's not to say, as you're pointing out rightly so, dashing my hopes of an early victory that this is going to happen overnight. But, things will move forward. Okay, so those are the... So I think to sort of end off, I would say that you've got to consider this not just as elements of data in this, but it's really about the complete research life cycle, which, of course, has all these different pieces, right? Ideas come, you generate hypotheses from ideas, you conduct experiments to test those hypotheses, that generates data which you analyze and you comprehend from those results, and then, of course, you publish it, and then you whip that around to write a grant so you can actually develop more ideas. So, and then we have resources that support that research life cycle. Some of them have been around effectively unchanged for a long time, which is a bit depressing. Authoring tools, most people still author in, probably not this audience, but for us mere mortals in things like Word. That's not necessarily the best environment for this kind of thing. Lab notebooks have never, in my experience, we've never really had success with lab notebooks. And then suddenly Evernote comes along, and everyone in my lab's using that because it's dead simple and we get lots of, and it's people using it around the table, So there are these things happening, but I think one of the problems is that they kind of plug into the pipeline, but they don't plug into each other. So there's very little interoperability between any of these things. And I think that is where, I could see really improvements and massive change being made. And then, of course, there's sort of communities and a whole series of things on the other side of this that isn't really the technologies that that come into play. The emergence of communities. I'm very intrigued by how communities emerge and grow and flourish and do things in some instances. In other cases, just die on the vine. And then within that mix, you've got, things like GitHub, which are clearly very successful. But we can clearly do a lot better with some of these things. And in my own absolutely analytical way, I actually tried to evaluate these things, so which is what I've done here. So if you have a Swiss flag, it means this is doing okay, right? It's a kind of a neutral thing. If you have clapping hands, I'd say it's actually doing well on average. If you've got skull and crossbones, then there's definitely room for improvement. This has absolutely no meaning whatsoever, except I like doing it. But this is sort of, in my mind, where we want to be going. And, the next step for my way of thinking about doing this, and this is almost precursive to some of the things that have already gone out of the door as RFAs at NIH, is we really got to get a handle on the notion of research objects. I mean, it's quite stunning that the publishing industry could all, as cutthroat as they are with each other, could all come together and agree to use digital object identifiers. We should at least be able to come together and use research object identifiers and then gradually build on that so we can begin to identify all of these pieces. I had a dream the other night. I dreamt that everything that I did had a research object identifier associated with it. That then became a string, a regular expression, which I then could immediately compare to other regular expressions, and I could see what research I'd done, how similar or different it was to someone else's. It was only a dream. But anyway, but that seems to me the kind of next type of thing we should be doing. And then the other thing that we're really pushing on, well, many things actually, but just this week, is data metrics, because, I think we must begin to measure better how we're using the data that's coming now and we already have. So which will then drive some changes in the reward system, I hope. So don't hesitate to email me if you want to push back or you have questions or anything like that. And I appreciate the dialogue, and let's have a bit more. Thank you.
And thank you very much, Philip. And we have time for questions. And before that, let me wear my hat as the moderator here and ask the first question. You talked about putting all those millions of dollars into developing data scientists. Do you think we'll have a problem in the future where we have a data scientist, saturation problem? DSSP, it's called data scientist saturation problem, where you have all these people are there in the field, and they got to find them employment, I guess.
Well, maybe, I suppose. If we get to that point, I suppose a lot of things going to happen between now and then for us to get there, and that a lot of good things would happen on the way. So, markets are self-adjusting, and these people get retrained and all the rest of it, and there's actually a lot of discussion in that book about the second industrial revolution, about the perturbation that these kinds of things have on society and jobs and so on. But it happened during the industrial revolution. It will happen again. Maybe this data thing will be the third revolution or whatever at some point. But I don't, one step at a time. I think it's going to be a while before we get to that problem.
Okay. Gary?
RDA was mentioned this morning by our keynote speaker, and issue of data types was mentioned by you, and I just wanted to point out that as part of RDA, there are work groups, and one of which is developing a data type registry, and they're also working in this PID, persistent ID area, so that's something that might be leveraged in the future.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's true, I didn't make that connection, but, I actually gave a keynote at the first RDA meeting, and I talked to Fran Berman a lot, and other people, of course, associated with it. And I'm pleased to see that's really seems to be getting some traction and taking off. These are important developments, and it sort of comes back to these notions of communities. And one of the things I've observed is that community, that's a little different. I mean, that's got some pretty significant funding. But there are lots of efforts, and you can imagine this around ontologies for sure, where a group of people get together because they're passionate about this and they start to do it, but their strength is actually coming up with the ontology, not the organization or some aspect or outreach or something associated with it. And yet a small amount of money that would actually really help these communities sort of get to the next level and be successful. And frankly, I mean, I've been in this situation a couple of times, and I've always looked at NIH, NSF primarily, and never found a means by which that small amount could be found. And yet, foundations like Doris Duke, Gordon Betty Moore, Sloan Foundation have actually supported me in these kinds of things. So one of the things, I think it doesn't take RDA a quantity of money necessarily, but small amounts of money can really help these things. Right? Just so that wasn't your question, but it just made me think about that. But I think it is really important that we should all try and come together on these things as much as possible. And I think it would be. So if you take that to how this will work, first of all, Fran was very much involved in the Data Discovery Index. She chaired the workshop that sort of led to it. So I think what we'll see when that's awarded, I mean, one, it's going to be, I'm not sure what it's going to be, but it may end up being a contract, in which case, if that happens, there'll be quite some significant oversight. And that's an opportunity to say, okay, You folks have got to go over there and start working with RDA on this, because they're already doing this, they've done this and that. I mean, I'm getting away from this, it's not invented here, it's got to happen.
One small follow-up, if I could, on that, is that when you're thinking about data types, you still have to think about hierarchies of types, but there are inadequate semantics often in those taxonomies, and so as you're doing that work, it's important to start thinking about including some semantics through things like ontological schemas.
Yeah. I would agree with that. On the other hand, I was involved in, you know, in the thing that we did in structural biology. I think it was too complex. So it's finding that balance. But certainly, yeah, this is important.
Yeah. We have two questions, Brent and Todd. So then
I thought it was an excellent talk, one comment, and then one question. Francis Collins gave an excellent presentation on this very thing at the TEDMED conference last year. And you might want to show the video or include a link of that. Second thing is, last year I was asked by congressional staff working on the Data Act what I would recommend be done. And this is what I recommended, and I think you're moving in that direction. I'd like to get your comment on it. It was to have a chief data officer for the government and for every agency that would lead a team of data scientists that would work on significant scientific and business problems with data and document the results so that you'd have a permanent link, hopefully, to how the data was collected, where it's stored, and what are its results. And so they liked that idea, and they suggested that I show them how that could be done. So we have a community of about 4,000 data scientists in the D.C. area that participate in regular meetups. And the part of that I lead, we have about 180 people that are working with big data. And we actually get teams of data scientists to work with data sets and present the results answering those three questions so that it is reproducible, like Francis Collins suggested at TEDMED last year. So you're moving in that direction. You are the chief data officer. You just need teams of data scientists that work on very high priority data sets and document the results and share them with others.
Well, I'd really appreciate if you would contact me offline so I can follow up with this because, yeah, I mean, this has to be crowdsourced. You know, these are huge needs. And everybody who wants to, all of that energy has to be corralled into things that are going to actually work. I mean, all I can do with a small team is essentially, direct traffic. I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
Okay. Yeah. So I think last question, Todd, because we need to move on.
If you can answer the question quickly.
I doubt it.
if not, I'll talk to you later. If you could expand more on what your notion of a research object is or might be and how that may or may not compare to a notion Leibniz may have had that's similar, at least it sounds similar to me.
No, I mean, they are. This has come up in different contexts, and I don't claim to, essentially what it is it's something that you choose to define. It could be some data, could be a piece of software, but it's something that you identify uniquely, and it's something that has provenance. And it's something that is likely to have some level of metadata beyond provenance associated with it. That's probably the extent of my thinking on what that should be. And one of the thoughts I've had, because in that previous slide, this seems to me to be almost a prerequisite next step to anything, is really to convene people to actually come and help sort of really specify what this should be. Because then, my goal is that when a grant is awarded in, probably realistically 2 years from now from the NIH, there's going to be, because you're already going to be needed to put this data into the public domain through the OSDP initiative, that data should go in there as, essentially a research object. So it has this community predefined set of criteria associated with it. So, and I sort of started to feel that alone would almost be like the second internet. It would be, suddenly we'd have, packets moving, we'd have some kind of communication and accessibility. People could start aggregating these things and doing amazing things with them just by virtue of these simple tags.
Okay. Thank you very much, Philip, again, for that wonderful talk. And we appreciate you coming here and enlightening us. We have the next track here. Let me see if I can get this thing. One thing I'd like to point out is that we do not have a break in this, if you see this very carefully. Okay? It's not intentional that we don't want you to have a break. What we're going to do is that we have actually some cold drinks and some bars out there. And I think after the first session, the track session, around 3:45 or so, we might want to take a 15-minute break, bio break, and then we'll get some water and things. So let's get on to the 3:45 p.m. session, which is, sorry, 3 p.m. session, which is track A. And I believe, Gary, you're going to, who's going to?
All three of you
are going to talk? Okay, now I'll let you, now who's going to, you're going to coordinate this, I think. Yeah.
Assuming you just need to use these slides, this would be the easiest thing to.
This advance, is it right there?
Yeah. And
no, that's not it. That's not.
Sorry.
Well, this is on reuse of slides. So I'm Gary Bergcross, along with my co-chairs here, Mike and Andrea. We're going to give a three-part conversation here about the semantic content reuse, which should be coming up shortly. So I'll do the first part of this and then pass it over to Mike, who will pass it over to Andrea. So loading. So here we are. Let's
remember,
see.
Say the slide number.
Okay. Oh, sure, yeah. Okay, so this introduces the topic, which is track A, semantic content reuse. Notice that we're out of order, so A, we thought we would be among the first presenters. So some of our information sort of has been well covered, so you'll be familiar with you. So to begin with, this is a summary of what we did. Like other tracks, we had two sessions of presentations, January and March. We had a very extensive email dialogues on the forum about some of these topics. We have a discussion and community page, which you should look at. The links are in the summit pages. And we started out with track A goals, which is to define the conditions for reuse of semantic content. This included things like concepts as well as what was called here meta-ontologies, which are essentially linking ontologies, ontologies about other ontologies and maybe connections between them. We had the idea of approaching this through discussion of modularization, and we wanted to cover best practices. And in particular, we wanted to talk about design patterns. So one of our early speakers covered the idea of ontology design patterns. Again, these are all things that you've heard a little bit about. And we also recognized that there would be an important role for things like tooling, including ontology repositories, which are not mentioned before. So that was sort of our beginning. We evolved over time as we went along, but here was our sort of going in idea about how this track related to the overall topic for the symposium this year. Again, Mike covered this well in his introduction, the idea that semantics plays an increasing role within big data and linked open data. We wanted to, as part of our mission, to leverage common semantic content in order to reduce the burdens of building new quality ontologies or not having to build them from scratch and avoid some of the difficulties of different ontologies and may be able to bring them together. As I say, that's the meta-ontology idea. When we were talking about semantic content, we defined a very broad range going from top-level ontologies, very extensive ontologies, to modular ontologies, to patterns, and so forth. And we recognized going in that the idea that there would be we would want to talk about some methodologies for constructing these things, the idea of bottlenecks and issues, and also tools. As has been discussed before, we saw this is highly interrelated. So, slide four. I've got a good hand signal on that. As we started, I gave actually an overview of some of the issues, and I used this particular slide, which is sort of like the picture of the big data landscape. And you don't have to read all the things here. You recognize there are going to be things like big computing structures and platforms. There's going to be the cloud in there. There's lots of analytics, and our speakers covered lots of analytics. But you don't find semantics in this particular sort of slide. So the idea was that while inside efforts, people recognized the need for semantics, for semantic interoperability of data, to a large extent, in some places, it's being ignored, certainly in some funding and looking at the landscape via Gardner, at least, it would seem to be ignored. Here's a slide I also used in part of my early introduction, which is to actually look at a particular a big data effort. This is in the case of hydrology, as it mentions here. Hydrology folks, the QASI folks, a consortium of people, have been sort of trying to develop standardized vocabularies because there's lots of people who have water terminologies, and so they have, in this case, I've featured three different things they've done. One, they built sort of a database that's shown on the upper left here, observations database, the data model, relational thing.
And it's not much semantics in there. There were sort of tables on units and measures and things of that nature for any particular given item, such as water temperature or acidity of water and so forth. Not much semantics in there. In the middle of the graphic, they essentially created a tool to show some of the terms they were using. But if you look at the structure of the vocabulary in there, they don't have defined relationships very well. They have things like other and so forth. And it's more of a navigational thing than anything else. It's not really a standard vocabulary that's useful except for finding terms that might be applicable. And finally, the last thing on the lower left is their effort at ontology, which is sort of a hierarchy, but it's not a consistent hierarchy. And so what they're calling ontology is really doesn't pass from ontology. But it does represent sort of peoples in the big data realm sort of trying to back into semantics and ontology and recognizing that there's gaps that they have. This was my slide to show the relationship between the tracks, and it's actually been covered. Mike's introduction on that, track B and C already covered some of these relationships. So you heard as much about reuse in the track on obstacles as you might hear within our presentation. So it's highly related, as well as the idea of the data variety track and reuse. So the all this slide adds new is that the idea is that reuse itself is a bottleneck and impeded by lack of proper tooling, as has actually been mentioned before. Okay, so one of the evolutions of our discussion has been to include the idea of sharing as well as reuse. So this particular slide makes the point, and this has been part of our discussion online, that shareability, how do you create a semantic artifact that somebody else is able to reuse is very important as a front end to reuse itself. So that's something that we got into. And we also noted going along that reuse issues are not unique to ontologies and schemas. Indeed, they are very common within software reuse, and some common problems occur there. And going down to the bottom of this particular slide, why reuse? I've mentioned previously that it's the idea, as in software, is to reduce the developmental effort, expand the benefits, that is, get more return on investment, and try to improve the quality of the original content. Okay, so as we were going along working with the summit organizers, there were some – so I'm sorry, I haven't been saying that. Slide 8, thank you. I need help here on that. Slide 8 on broad questions. As we go along, so the organizers sort of had some broad questions and thought that these were some of the things that we should be addressing within our effort. There are four on here. What range of semantic content is being shared and reused on the web, from vocabularies to more formalized and axiomized ontologies? What are the issues with that reuse, which we'll cover in some detail? What ontologies are available, being used, and required? And some of our speakers talked about that. And how can we find these? And that's, again, a topic that was discussed previously in terms of using things like LOV. Around these questions, we developed the idea of issues, tools, success stories, and best practices, which will make up some of the latter part of our presentation here today. Okay. As we started, we wanted to get discussion going. So part of the discussion on the forum was important to us, and we've had some very good things. This is slide 9. And so we developed 7 specific track questions. I'm not going to go through reading those, but you will actually some of these were discussed in more detail than the others, but they were an important part of our effort is to get the community discussing things. And for my last slide, before turning slide 10, you have to say the slide number, Mike. This is our list of speakers, starting with Mike, who sort of gave an overview of the track to begin with. I gave an introductory talk on reuse, and all of these, of course, are available online. Pascal Hitzler talked about ontology design patterns, particularly within the EarthCube effort. Andrea, our co-champion here, gave a talk on FIBO and reuse within that. Mike and Megan Katsumi gave a talk on reasoning. Reasoning has been discussed here as something, how important is that? What type of reasoning do we want to have? John Sower, then that was essentially the speakers for our first February session. Then in March, we had John Sower giving an overview, including the idea of knowledge sharing. Then Mike Dumontier gave a talk going into big linked open data and provided a lot of biomedical examples that are of interest. And finally, Kingsley Eaton gave a talk, again, on big linked open data. Okay, that's slide 10. Here's slide 11, and here's our co-chair,
thanks,
Mike.
Aaron. And which button do I press to remind
to
myself
right.
to say the
yeah,
number
yeah,
of that
to
one?
The right.
Right. So every time I press that button, I'm going to say the number of the slide.
Okay.
I shall probably forget. So on this middle section, then, I'm going to try and look at what we did to draw together some of the common themes that we saw in those presentations and take a deep dive into a couple of those and basically see what lessons we could pull out, and then Andrew will pick up and consolidate those lessons for us. So just a quick look at some of the common themes, and then I'll do a slightly deeper dive in the next slide. So one theme that I think was clear right from the beginning really was, you know, when we talk about ontologies and we talk about what they're for, different people come to it from different perspectives. We heard Matthew earlier about ontologies as a conceptual model in a development life cycle, and that is a very important use of those. Then, of course, there's semantic web-based applications, reasoning, search applications, and so on. So whenever we talk about an ontology, and whether we're talking about reusing it or designing it for reuse or whatever, there's different things that they were originally created for. So I think that was one common theme that informs a lot of the rest of it, including the next question, which I've framed in a slightly tongue-in-cheek way, but nonetheless I think I wanted to put out there, which is, what makes it meaningful? Is it meaningful because you can reason over it, or can you reason over it because it's meaningful? And different people you talk to might have a different, very emphatic answer to that question, or it might be that I'm being slightly cheeky there. But there is the distinction between how you apply knowledge representation theory to think about meaning and apply the way in which, you know, philosophers have thought about meaning for years versus how you apply reasoning and logic and so on to prove that something that you think is meaningful really is, and that you have a usable and reusable ontology. So those different perspectives, again, comes back to different usage and so on. Another recurring theme, and we'll have a little slightly deeper dive into this in a moment, is the idea of ontology patterns or ontology design patterns, depending whether you think an ontology is a design thing or an attempt to articulate reality. What is meant by ontology design patterns? How can they be used? How can they be applied, and how do they help in reuse? We'll have a slightly closer look at that in a moment. And another common theme which really ties into all that is what it takes to be able to identify what's reusable. So you're setting out to do some project. You want to not reinvent the wheel. You want to think about reuse of stuff. So here's an ontology that's out there, say, for countries or something. You want to talk about a country, okay, well, what do I need to know about this? And there are a number of different themes that came over again and again from our different speakers, such as what was the intended scope that ontology was built for? What was its application? So we had, in the hackathon, we had one ontology that was recommended to us that talked about the impact of something or other, but it was specific to the impact of drugs and drug tests, and yet the wording wouldn't have told you that. So what's the intended scope? That tells you what the level of abstractions is going to be. Another common theme was how confident you are in that ontology. Is it well annotated? Is there enough in annotation or comments or whatever in the ontology to tell you what the designers of that ontology were actually thinking of when they did that, and therefore what the meanings were intended to be? Another common theme was finding common or similar terms, overlaps, underlaps even, between terms in one or another ontologies. If you're integrating a bunch of ontologies, three of them might have a term for event. Two of them might be framed in the same way, or they might not, which comes on to another common theme, which is in what theory of the world is each of these ontologies framed in terms of? You know, there's maybe two or three different ways of thinking of events. There's different ways of thinking of roles or things performing roles or whatever. And in fact, this is again a common theme that came out, there's no one ontology anyway. So you've got to think about what are the micro theories, and are you trying to reuse something that is maybe not compatible with the micro theory that you're using? And so there's a strategy aspect there, when to use, this really came out more from conversations around the place, in fact, when to use a whole ontology, when to use a snapshot of it, or take an extract, a subset of terms, say you've got a U.S. postal addressing ontology that deals with what goes on an envelope or an American letter, but you actually want to talk about address concepts, you take a small subset of those. How do you deal with that? What tooling do you need to make that happen? And again, another theme that came out of John Sower's talk was, in particular, and others as well, was how you get the right kind of tooling to get the interaction between knowledge workers, logic experts, semantic web reasoning folks, and so on. So, and in fact, there's a lot of best practice stuff in John's slide, which we've shown a link to here, which brings us back to the world of old-fashioned knowledge representation and how we bring that into the modern era of reasoning and so on. So that was the very, very quick look at the common themes. Next slide, slide 12. I'm going to take a lot less time on the next few, but I just wanted to kind of talk around the sense of what came out of our different sessions. So a slightly deeper dive on a couple of those. So slide 12. When we talked about ontology design patterns or ontology patterns, there was actually a couple of kinds of pattern. When I went back through and looked at all the different presentations, a couple of different things came out. We had a lot of good examples of what I might informally call ontological abstractions, meaningful representations of a concept such as event. So there's a common event pattern. Event is something of the time and a place and certain other things about it. You could take that pattern and extend it and reuse it. But then there's also more, I don't know what the right word for this would be. I've just put axiom patterns, but kind of more designy kind of things, like when to use a string versus when to use a thing, you know, when to use data type properties versus object properties, when to use different partitions to represent stuff as common modeling patterns, so that in an ontology you might want to reuse, are there common ways they've approached similar problems, not necessarily common semantic abstractions like event, but common kinds of pattern that can be reused to give you some consistency on how the ontology is used. So those two kinds of patterns were of use in thinking about reuse. There's also there was a lot about implementation and reuse strategies, looking at the linked data versus the sort of top-down ontology kind of approach, when to derive meaning by examining example data and sort of defining what are the meanings of the concepts in that data and building it from the bottom up, versus when to have common high-level abstractions and patterns like event and so on and work down by extending those, or how to bring it into the middle. We saw some good examples like the trajectory ontology, which was based on event and which could be built out into cruise terms and trip terms and so on. And another issue, this comes back to tooling again, which Andrea will talk more about, is how to be able to integrate. You know, if you're looking at reusing a bunch of ontologies, we'll look at some examples of this just now, there isn't really at the moment the tooling to kind of get different ontologies together and look at the overall system of imports and reuse and what's in what ontology and so on and be able to develop your kind of integrated ontology solution. And a couple of other things that came out. Ontology has common business language, common meaning for a common point of reference, like vocabularies, but with a much more ontological precision versus common logical expression and so on. And as I mentioned before, how to get the right mix, there's a later slide, so I won't go much on this at the moment, on the interaction between knowledge representation folks and ontology experts and so on, and what tooling is needed to cover that. So, so very briefly then, slide 13, thank you. I pushed the button and I forgot to say the number. So the next couple of slides really give you a flavor of what some of these things were that came out of those sessions, just to pick up the themes that I just kind of touched on just now. So reuse issues in general then. So to be able to successfully reuse semantic content, i.e. ontologies and you know, other resources that have some kind of semantics in them, it's important first, excuse me, to understand how the content is being used and what methods are available to be able to coordinate reuse, what tools exist, and so on. There's a later slide that picks this up in more detail, the need for tooling for modularity and for getting documentation of the ontologies and so on. And If you look at things like big data and linked data and so on, their ability to make use of existing ontologies and reuse them is somewhat bottlenecked by the paucity of tools that do more than just show you the individual ontology and show you some more integrated view. So reuse then is dependent both on the availability of well-documented ontology content and tooling that supports finding that content and incorporating it into your project, kind of like you would do in conventional technology where you'd have some kind of system view of what you're putting together. So on slide 14, when we talk about reuse, and the next slide covers more of the details of reuse and so on. Ah, thanks. I should have thought of that. Bottle of water. well, I want us to think about each of these questions from two different perspectives. One that we've focused on so far is you're somebody who wants to reuse some other ontology. What are the things that you need to know or find in order to be able to reuse that? What do I look for? Some of that is ontology quality, but some of it is knowing what the ontology was built for in the first place to know how appropriate it is for what you want. The opposite perspective of that is, what if you're the person who is building an ontology not just for one standalone application, but with the intention of it being reused? So I guess almost by definition, that means you're building a standard, not an ontology for an application. And one thing we found was that some of the decisions that are appropriate to make when you're creating an ontology for one application, where you have neither the budget nor the need to think about some of the broader semantic issues, as long as you can make that application reason and deliver the right results, may be very different to what you have to think about if you want your ontology to be reused by others and become part of some ecosystem of reusable ontologies. So slide 15, then a deeper dive into these reuse conditions, is a couple of things that came out, again, of the different talks and of the conversations on the email and elsewhere. What are the things that are needed for reuse? So firstly, of course, you have to be able to find it. You have to have easily findable and accessible semantic content, i.e. ontologies, has to be documented, and that documentation has to include what were the intended meanings of the terms, in what context, what your use cases were that you intended it to be used for. So if you're reusing something that was built for one application, is there enough documentation for you to know whether or not you can reapply it in your own application? And then you, if you're the one reusing the ontology, what are your competency questions that you want your overall application to answer? What micro theories, I mentioned earlier, you can have different ways of framing concepts. Not all of those ways are mutually compatible with each other. So under what micro theories are you building your solution, and how does that affect what is the ontology you're reusing, and when is it best to reuse content within that development lifecycle for your application? Another critical aspect is that the content is in a form that's conducive for reuse. So far we haven't really talked about different syntaxes, but you know, it may be that the community of practice that owns the knowledge of what some meaning is has framed it in some formalism other than what you might be using. There's a lot of good business semantics out there framed in UML or in Excel or in other things that are not OWL. Of course, you've got to be able to put them in some meaningful form while not losing the business meaning that went into those. Do you know how to do that? Do you know what it takes to get from the one syntax to another? And even if some community of practice has definitively said what is the meaning of some concept that they happen to own, have they done that in a way that's logically consistent? And if so, are the micro theories within which they framed it? I'll give you a simple example of what I mean by micro theories. If you look at time, there's the W3C model, which has interval and instant, and then there's the Allen relations model, which is expressed in the OMG date-time vocabulary, which doesn't recognize the concept of instant. So you can't use both. So you've got to know which of those your ontology is framed in terms of. And finally, do you trust the content and its quality, and do you believe it will be maintained? If not, you might want to take a snapshot of it at a point where it represents what you like, put your own URI into that snapshot or something, and you do need some broadly standard metadata and annotations for all that to work. Okay, I'm running over now. So slide 16, just a couple of quick examples then, just to pull all that together. Schema.org is a very good example of some widely used vocabulary material for describing the contents of a web page. It addresses some of the issues we talked about, finding reusable content, managing size and complexity and so on. It is very much a vocabulary, as we've seen. The concepts are very well documented. It's clear how to use it and so on. So a lot of those things we identified are there. Slide 17, here's an example of what an integrated view between several ontologies would look like. So you've got one ontology which defines a couple of genes as kind of gene, and then another couple on the side there which are more specific to that individual kind of gene. So you can see because some of the concepts are compatibly defined, you can create a wider view of those. This is from Michel Dumontier's talk, slide 17. Then on slide 18, here's really the questions we looked at for big data, well, for linked data, but it applies to big data as well. Do you build the ontology first from top down based on well-established design patterns, or do you start from the linked data and then build upwards to extract your ontology from that, or do you do a bit of both and get them to meet in the middle? Kingsley Idahen came up with some interesting ideas here on how part of being able to achieve this balance is to know when to enable or disable inferencing rules on the different available ontology, whether to use those rules conditionally, and not try and think you'll get to something that's absolutely perfect. And slide 19 brings up another research question, which comes back to something we've talked about from the beginning. Are all ontologies needed to be used for reasoning applications, and do you have to be able to reason over it to be able to use it? We heard from the linked data folks that you do. But are the ontologies out there even able to support anything more than the most trivial reasoning problems? Or are they actually designed with not enough formal semantics to support half of what you might want to do if you're reusing the ontology? So those are the kind of questions that came up from Megan Katsumi and Michael Gruninger's talk. So with that, I'll hand over to Andrea, slide 20 now. I'm sorry I took a bit longer than I expected. But,
Do you want your water?
Thank you.
Okay. So I get to wrap up in like 5 minutes so you can all ask questions. The ending part of this talk is kind of about what we learned, and it's not so much, just the questions or a summary, but it's kind of going beyond that to include all the conversations and to start talking about what we learned. Tooling, big thing. I mean, everybody already talked about tooling, but we had some very specific requirements that we discussed. The need for the tools to understand modular technologies, modular semantics, modular components that you want to bring together and help with that, and help with it in a visual way, not just maybe with using OWL equivalent class, you know, because without visualization, as your ontologies get bigger, obviously, as your set of concepts get bigger, you get blown away by just trying to keep in your head. Nobody can keep in their head all of that kind of information. But governance, that was a really big piece of what somebody needed to be able to trust in ontology. How has it evolved? For what uses has it evolved? Who's taken a look at it? What were the competency questions? I coined a new term on the web, on the email the other day, of using competency queries, that you could actually write your Sparkle queries from your competency questions and execute them, see what happens. And then it's search, and this came up in the NIH talk, too. How do you get the metadata to search, to even find what is equivalent, to find what is useful, and all of those things? And, again, it doesn't have to be a full-blown ontology. It can be a vocabulary. How does the vocabulary, could that inspire a deeper semantic meaning or deeper relationships? So it's not just having a tool that it can import OWL or can import common logic, but can actually take a look at Thesauri and schema.org and bring it, things together that can be broadly usable. And one of the comments that John Soa made, which I came kind of from the commercial world, and I work for like CA, so at the time, you know, doing stuff for IT is kind of important. Lining up with the stuff that the programmers use, that the IT departments use, the standard IT tooling would be huge and would kind of open up the space, because if you say, you know, to the standard IT guys, go learn OWL or go learn Common Logic, you know, no way. But you give them tools and you visualize it and you take a step back from that, that's a huge thing, and that opens up, you know, way more possibilities for the whole world of ontologies and semantics. Some of the tooling we took a look at was the Open Ontology Repository, and there's a lot of good information in there. There's a lot of ontologies in there, but doing more with it, doing more with the metadata, more with the search, more with the visualization, that was one thing. And then, again, lots of people referenced the linked open vocabulary. And some things that we kind of didn't get to, but I still thought we should list as questions. Are there differences between what you need to support the development of these ontologies and schemas than what you need to use them? And I think there are. And we don't have either, really. So we don't even have all the metadata we need. But that's another kind of aspect of the whole tooling that we need to think about. Slide 21, of course, that's your mess of all the possible things that you have out there to choose from. So how do you choose anything from the mess, especially the center of the mess, which you can't even read? Michelle Dumontier commented on how complex everything was and how to coordinate that. It's that it's chaotic and unwieldy. So this came out in some of the earlier slides in this deck, the need for consistent metadata that came out in the NIH talk. And then reuse that's actually affected by user feedback, a recommender system, as it were, to put feedback in place and to actually have that feedback have both a positive and a negative effect, the stick and the carrot, as it were. Then back to the governance. Not just because you publish something doesn't mean it's good. It has to be looked at by other people, commented on. If anybody thinks their first version of something is going to be right, I mean, it's like writing code. I mean, that's why they do Agile. It's not right the first time. Revise it, use it. You know, that's huge, the use part of it. The more you use it, the more you find that you made mistakes or that things could be better. And then acceptance. Be it crowdsourced acceptance, recommender kind of acceptance, or formal acceptance in a standards body or W3C, that is a standards body, but, you know, in a broader group. Some of the other things were, how do you do the knowledge acquisition? John Soa did part of his talk about that. You know, traditionally you get the subject matter expert talking to your knowledge engineer who puts the ideas together. I got 2 minutes. Oh. I got 22 minutes. Oh, slide 22. You got to say that. I was like, victory. Okay. Peace. Yeah. Okay. Using controlled natural languages. The problem with controlled natural languages, other than the good side of it is we can use them. The bad side of it is most normal people never remember all the controls that go into the controlled natural language and make mistakes. Verification testing, that was mentioned earlier, the importance of having a way to test. And that was kind of this the last bullet on there, you know, run some predefined Sparkle queries. That's what kind of led me to the competency query part of my email the other day, of early this morning, that you can actually do some testing. You can do some verification. Well, my God, if you wrote, you know, an ontology and you can't even pass your own competency questions, clearly something's wrong. But that, again, could be something that somebody could write some simple queries and add to your competency queries to validate ontologies to do more than what you thought or make some minor modifications and then validate them. So these were all things that came up as part of our conversation in Track A, not in all the talks, but in the emails and everything else. And I'm pushing the button.
What about the down button? Does that do it?
I can. Oh my goodness. Can I mouse it?
Yes.
I will mouse it. I will mouse it. Oh, there we go. Let's try down. Really? New. I tried left mouse too.
Can you drag on the side over here? Okay.
Oh, there we go. There we go. That'll work. There we go.
I pressed the down key.
Oh. Oh, okay. Best practices. I'm not going to read these slides to you. I'm not going to go through all of them. We went from everywhere from upper ontologies to really specific teeny tiny patterns of ontology design patterns with like three classes in them. So I think the second major bullet there is what's most interesting. You know, be aware that the way you look at a problem, the way you think about it, the purpose that you use it for, it will affect what you come up with. So one of our recommendations, actually, as part of the governance and everything else, was try to get more than one use, more than one domain view of something. Because clearly, if my kind of saying is a use case of one always works. So if you design something and you have a use case of one thing, of course, you'll address it. But if you're designing something more broadly, try to think of the problem more broadly. And I'm going to push that down arrow. Okay. Modularization, we did talk a lot about that. Other people talked about it. One of the things we had hoped to do more of, which we didn't really get to, was actually collect best practices, collect exemplars, to actually put some concrete pieces of ontologies, patterns, best practices out there and have exemplars of them. But we started to do that, and I won't say we got very far on it, but in the email list, we got farther on it, too. Understanding, in terms of modularization, though, an aspect of that is how does something evolve? How do your pieces evolve over time? How does the pattern maybe evolve over the domain? It might be that the general pattern or the general concept works, but you have to tweak it a little bit for a different domain. Capturing that level of variability or those contexts would actually help or maybe inspire reuse in different areas that someone hadn't even thought of, not only for the original design, but for one aspect of reuse versus another aspect of reuse. And now I'm on slide 25. I forgot to warn you. Okay. Integration. We did talk about integration. This first bullet is kind of valuable to think about, and I think in the hackathon, Mike, that you ran, it came out that if you describe the concepts separate from their encoding and allowed multiple encodings, and then maybe even describe the concepts separate from all their properties, that you could maybe enable more reuse, that this concept might work, but a specific property didn't work or doesn't work. Clearly separating out the axiom patterns, as you called it, from the concept patterns, that's valuable. But we kind of found that the more you separated things out and clearly defined their use, the more reusable things would end up being. It's important in that second sub-bullet on slide 25 there, take care to distinguish what's really definitive. This means X, or this means Y. That wouldn't kind of go into a kind of sub-area of your definition of a concept, whereas this means X in the area of hydrology, that would be appropriate to separate out. So we call that distinguishing the definitive entities from the pragmatic ones. Whether those are good words or not, that's what we called it. Using the integrating modules, which is the equivalent classes, but being consistent. So once you kind of establish a pattern, stick with it and don't jump all over the place. From Michel Dumontier's talk, he said, let's be tactical. And this came back to know your competency questions, know your area, know what you want to achieve, and then steal, reuse from other places to make it happen, but make sure you hit your objective. And in terms of formalizing, and this is for reuse, document everything via well-established labels. We started talking about SCOS and the Dublin Core stuff. Describe why, how something was created, how it's tested, what it was meant to do. These are back to the competency questions. Try to get multiple domains so you actually get multiple use cases. So you look at a problem a little bit more broadly. Plan for evolution, and don't ever think your first pass is right. And then back to this domain and range question, which came up this morning. Take care to use the domains and ranges to clarify what you mean, but don't lock down a meaning. You know, this thing must mean a time instant before you really know that something must be a time instant in the example that you gave of microtheories. And so this came out in the emails. Float the domains and ranges when you're trying to be generic, and when you need to be specific, maybe in an application domain, be specific and don't be afraid of it. And naming, this is my last slide, so this is quick. I'm not going to go into a lot about that. We had there's religious discussions about names and surrogate names versus real names and having meaning or not. I'm just acknowledging there are both approaches. What came out to be important was maybe you do present things in multiple languages, and that's not a bad thing. You can use your labels to do that. And that was kind of the second bullet. Regardless of what your identifier scheme is, make sure that you're addressing all your audiences. And then make sure that you don't pick a name that's overly generic. You know, I picked the name time when I really meant seconds, you know, in the Gregorian calendar past 1972 or something. Don't pick too generic names or too specific names when, you know, be appropriate for the content and the concept that you're actually modeling. So those were our main points. I think there was a question. We got started late. Please.
Michael Uschel, Semantic Arts. We have heard repeatedly from different talks during the day about this notion of a conceptual ontology versus an application ontology, and the idea that if you can think of it as analogous to, in database land, conceptual versus logical versus physical. Now, in database land, the reality is it was a nice theory to do things that way, but once reality got their way, the applications and physical databases evolved, and nobody kept track of the concept. So in the context of, you know, building ontologies commercially for our clients, we advocate this notion of let's do this but do it right, conceptual kind of, sort of we call it the middle layer design and the lower layer application ontology. But what we're realizing is over the course of time, initially advocating this idea, and now the reality on the ground is who's going to do that extra work? That's a lot of extra work. Right, and it's hard to tell your client, oh, you need this other one up here, but then we have to keep managing it. So it's just kind of like a little bit of reports from the field. It's nice in theory, just like it was for database, but what's the evidence that it will ever work in practice? I'd be interested to talk to someone who has experienced it working. I'm beginning to wonder whether it's actually practical.
And one of the things I would just want to say is if you could improve your tooling so that you did visualize your concept separate from all of the details, that you could actually visualize it from your serialization, that would be valuable. But also if you started to split, here are my main concepts and put it in one ontology that you visualized, and here are all the data properties that went with it in another subset, you might be able to keep your concepts and their key relationships separate and cleaner and better maintained. Of course, you always still end up with the devil in the details of reality.
If I could add, this reminds me of the sustainability issue that we had before. You mentioned ontologies and software have some similar things. Ontologies and data have some similar issues on how to be maintained. So that's one thing, making an investment, trying to get people to recognize the value of the investment. The thing I would add is I do like the conceptual to logical to physical model, but I think more in terms of agile methods now, so that when you are down at the bottom, you go back to the top, because what you're doing down at the application level may change the conceptualization you had before over time. So we should think of this iteratively over time as a sustainable investment.
I was just going to very briefly pick up those threads on that. There's really a governance issue there. I think if people are not maintaining some kind of conceptual model in some kind of engineering activity, then it's a false economy because the business is no longer driving what happens. And this really points to the tooling thing. And one thing I don't think we got to mention, but it started to come clear to me, is that you need different kinds of tools for managing ontologies in their published web-facing form, where you have certain disciplines around the URIs and imports and so on, versus the messy world of building the thing. And we do need to have that agile, test-driven kind of approach, which doesn't lose the conceptual. Otherwise, you're out of control, and you have a short-term benefit for a long-term disadvantage.
Last question.
Terry Longstreth. I'm resonating with Michael's thoughts on this, and I think one of the issues, maybe we want to talk about it next year, is the fact that once you've gotten ontology and you've started to use it, the question is, where are you using it, how are you using it, and how are you keeping track of that utilization, and how does the feedback of that get impacted? When you change your ontology, how many downstream applications do you want to make sure that are kept in sync with that? Or more to the point, how do you know that your downstream applications can even survive with changes? So a lot of this has to do, you know, and that's going outside the ontology realm, because your ontology is just a part of the bigger system.
It's like old-fashioned printed circuit boards. You know, which changes that you made would affect every user and which ones would only affect some. It's a major engineering challenge. I think Andrea had some really good points earlier.
And there's this whole concept of deprecated still there, but deprecated so you can maintain it. And one of the other things I was kind of playing around in Dublin Core and the SCOS, it's the replaces. You know, this thing replaces that thing. So that if you do deprecate it and you do replace something, you actually document what it's replaced by, as opposed to just throwing something new out there and then people scratch their heads.
And somebody raised the issue of multilingual in environments. Well, between two languages, you don't have synonyms in many cases.
Okay, so that's a little faster then. Okay. Yeah, that's fine then. So the bio break. Yeah. Sorry that we're getting a little delayed, but you got to get on time. Always that. Somehow we forgot the break in there. I think what happened is
the next session is
it was okay. Once before this happened this morning, where that was not working for 45 seconds or so, it was kind of weird.
Well, maybe the batteries are going off.
So this is a remote presentation then? Remote presentation. That's what it is.
Well, some of them, not all of them, I think.
This one. Yeah. No, then there's a hackathon. This is different. We have one session, track D. After track D, we have this one here. So we have more. This is the one where you said probably a lot of people talking about a lot of things.
We better let those people know that we're pushed back.
Yeah, is Ann in the... Hello, Ann? Or Ken? Who's going to give this? Peter? Who's going to do the track, next track, which is track D?
This is Ken.
Ken,
can you hear me?
Ken, we have a 10-minute break here, okay?
I've been online on the phone. Ann will not be available.
Ken, are you there?
Available. I'll be. Hello, can you hear me?
No, he's got the 10-minute break, okay. Anyway, we'll come back. I'll go to the restroom. And yes. I have to go.
send you one paper to make it quite the end.
Ken, you're still on the phone?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes. Do you have slides for the website, the PSMW site presentation?
No, I'm afraid I wasn't even aware that you were going to have a slide presentation today. Sorry, I've been just swamped with the students at the moment.
Don't worry, then. I will do a quick one from on-site. I'll just point people to the pages. But you have another one on the hackathon project. Maybe you work on that one. I'll take care of the website one. How about that?
Oh, that'll be great. I'll work on the other one, yeah.
Yep. Good.
It doesn't seem like Anne can get in. She just said she cannot dial in. Oh, she just said she made it. Yes, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can. Well, we could hear you all the time.
Oh, that's good. Let me know when to start.
Will do. Hold on.
Yep.
I'll let you do the next one.
Okay.
It's a pleasure.
Sounds good.
Okay, again, can I have your attention, please, everyone? Michael Gruninger, you want to bring? Okay, we are starting the track B, tackling the variety problem in big data. Ken, I guess Ken is going to talk right now. Ken, you're on.
Okay, thank you very much. It's really unfortunate that I couldn't be there with you. Circumstances prevented that. So I'll be talking today about the track D. And but let me begin by mentioning a little bit that I just finished being on the review panel for the BD2K that Philip Bourne talked about. And I came away with a lot of interesting new understanding about big data and the and its role. Now, I thought I'd mention a couple of things in the form of good news and bad news. The good news is that there's an enormous interest in data science. So that sounds great. The bad news is I see very little interest in data semantics. So that's kind of unfortunate. For example, degree programs are cropping up all over the place, including my own institution. And these programs tend to be very weak on any kind of semantics, including the one that we just created. Another example of good news is that within the review panel, certainly within BD2K, there was a lot of concern and interest in ontologies. Bad news, their idea of what an ontology is isn't quite what we might think of as an ontology. They have very narrow use cases and, in fact, usually just search. So from that point of view, ontologies are just little more than vocabularies, perhaps arranged in some weak taxonomy. And as a result, ontologies are frequently viewed as peripheral and not fundamental to the processes that they could serve. So let me then continue to slide two. We've already heard a lot about the potential of big data, so that shouldn't be new to any of you. Traditional techniques are inadequate, and the new techniques are much better, but the variety problem is typically handled with ad hoc techniques. And with the emergence of big data, which actually emerged quite a long time ago, over 30 years ago, there was this transition from information scarcity to information abundance. This is slide three. And we find that organizations have difficulty coping with this transition. So moving on to slide four, the characteristics of big data that are generally understood today are that it consists of either large amounts of data or a rapid pace of data acquisition, that's velocity, as slide four, or complexity of the data, which is called variety, or a combination of more than one of these. So I'm going to focus mainly on the variety problem, dealing with things like complexity of individual data item, whether you have books either structured or unstructured data and the complexity that that brings in, complexity of different data sources, and complexity even of data within a single source. So variety is actually a big subject. It's kind of unfortunate that, as I mentioned before, these new degree programs that are coming out like crazy today in big data emphasize volume and velocity and pay lip service to variety and really don't deal with it much at all. So going to slide five, the technology for big data is emerging that, you know, 20 years ago it was MapReduce. Techniques for handling variety are also emerging, particularly in our community. Problem is there's really very little connection between these two. And what I'm going to try to talk about today are different use cases for how these two communities could perhaps collaborate much better. Slide six, I listed there the session speakers. We had quite a wonderful collection of speakers in Track D. Eric Chan, Nathan Wilson, Ruth Jur, Mark Fox, Malcolm Chisholm, and Dan Brickley, Rosario Seda Sosa. And slide seven, let me go into more detail about a couple of the speakers. Eric Chan from Oracle talked about tool development, addressing many aspects of the variety problem, including important aspects such as provenance, metadata, hypothesis generation, and workflow processes. So that was Eric. Then Dan Brickley from Google talked about the variety problem on the web, which is an enormous resource with tremendous variety, and gave some overview of the lessons learned from schema.org for open link data. Then on slide eight, we had Malcolm Chisholm, who talked about data governance, which we've also heard in the Track A presentation. Malcolm Chisholm discussed what was involved in data governance and its implications for managing variety in big data. Then Ruth Jur had a very interesting talk about the National Snow and Ice Data Center. And this, her talk was particularly interesting because of it brought out a number of different use cases for how how our community and the big data community could successfully forge collaborations. So moving to slide nine, Nathan Wilson spoke about experiences with using semantic technology in a particularly messy ontology, the tree of life. This is species, genera, and various taxa that classify all life. And had some very interesting examples there of use cases. Mark Fox and Rosario Luceda Sosa from Toronto and IBM, respectively, both talked about different aspects of city data, which is yet another example of really messy data from a large variety of sources and how one can reconcile the kinds of data you get from all of these sources. So moving on to slide 10. So why would semantics be important? Well, the truth is that misunderstanding the data can result in invalid or misrepresented analyses. Actually, we heard about Philip Horn mentioned this as well. There are a number of papers that have come out that have basically claimed that most public research findings are not just unreproducible, they're actually false. And that there are many forms of bias that can invalidate the results. Perhaps the results might be valid, but just misunderstood. In many cases, might actually simply be false. The fact is, bias and observer effects are very difficult to recognize, especially if you don't have a really complete understanding of your data. And standard experimental procedures do not always eliminate bias. So these have been around for a while. These have been long recognized problems in the scientific research enterprise and presumably in any enterprise that involves the use of statistics, which is increasingly involving a lot of communities. The question is, could big data help or exacerbate this problem? It's not clear. Some people think it will help. Other people are not so clear. It could actually make things much, much worse. We'll see. on slide 11, so what could ontologies do to help with this? Well, in our track, we tried to find a number of possibilities, such as background knowledge, data structure itself, annotation of the data. A big area is provenance of the data, just how was the data created? How would you reproduce the data if you needed to? That's an enormous area, very little dealt with in many of the projects that I'm aware of, and certainly not much dealt with in many of these new degree programs in data science. And there are also privacy concerns that are also a big issue, very, very big issue in biology and medicine. But in general, it's a big concern. Slide number 12. There's still other opportunities that we could have for helping, which is data governance, integration, and quite a variety of techniques that Dan Brickley mentioned in his work. So now I'd like to switch somewhat to talking about the use cases that we try to identify. Try to abstract, perhaps not, I wouldn't go so far as to call these best practices, but rather more advice for how we as a community could find ways of better communicating with other communities, particularly the big data community, but there's still many other communities that are involved in data today. So the first one, slide 13, is a use case I called Harvest from Data Partners. So the idea is, rather than build it yourself, make use of collaborators. So you harvest data and, ontologies from various sources, from sources that you collaborate with. It's still a lot of work because you have to convert, formalize the input, integrate the sources. It's not easy, but the result can be very high quality, and it has a huge bonus. It has a built-in user community, since the user communities that you are harvesting from become basically your user base. So that's a good example of how one can seek to get a constituency by basically harvesting what they already have. Nathan Wilson gave an example of a trait bank that came from a number of communities associated with the Tree of Life and the Encyclopedia of Life community. The idea there was to take the taxonomy that we have in the Tree of Life and to enhance it with traits, with properties, so that it becomes more ontological. And he did that by not by just inventing these things on his own, but by actually harvesting them from the various communities. Mark Fox and Osaria Uceda Sosa gave examples of harvesting data and metadata from city data sources. And these are, again, very complicated sources. They're very individual sources might actually be small, but the same kinds of data will be available for many cities, and it can be very complicated to integrate them because of the very different assumptions that they make. But again, the advantage is that you now have quite a large community of individuals that would be very interested in in what you've harvested. Ruth Durer gave a very interesting example from the indigenous native communities in the Arctic region of how you can involve these communities and in an ontology development effort. And of course there's the web as a whole, which I didn't put on this slide, but it's Dan Brickley's work can be regarded as the schema.org and that Dan Brickley talked about represents millions of providers and is just an amazing integration of a huge collection of data partners. So then moving on to slide 14, here's another use case, which is actually been talked about in other tracks, is the modular development. The idea is that it's easier to reuse a smaller ontology and then larger ontologies and then to combine several of them to create an ontology that satisfies most of your requirements. So this is really part of the Track A theme. And it was satisfying to see examples of this. Withdrew in particular used this technique to develop an ontology for sea ice from several other ontologies. But there are many other examples. Now, moving on to slide 15. Interesting. This is an interesting use case where there are many models that are out there, often have been around for quite a long time. What we should regard as ontologies, and we could provide a valuable service by basically formalizing those existing models. Once they're formalized, you can then use this formalization to build tools based on these models. Eric Chan gave an example where he formalized the OODA loop and then extended this and generalized it. The OODA loop came from a surprising source. It came from the military. People were interested in the military in how fighter pilots process information. They basically came up with this, what is essentially just an informal model for the decision-making process called the OODA loop. And it's since been found that this OODA loop is used in a very large variety of decision-making processes, including the scientific enterprise, where hypothesis generation and testing is an important process in science. Another example of this formalization was Ruth Durer, who presented a formalization of existing techniques for describing sea ice conditions and indigenous knowledge about sea ice. So there was a very a large amount of this kind of informal knowledge that was built up over many centuries, millennia even, by the indigenous communities, and it's withstood the test of time, clearly, and it would seem appropriate to formalize that rather than to try to invent an ontology from scratch. The city data is yet another example where you take existing informal data models for city data and then you formalize them. And these are some interesting models because they involve axioms and rule bases, and they have immediate benefits for interoperability among the different sources of data in the various cities. The problem there is that you often have very simple data structures, columnar data usually, with little metadata available for it, and you have concepts. The example that Mark Fox presented was student-faculty ratio. Now, you would think student-faculty ratio would be something that would be generally agreed upon, but we found that it's the opposite. Even though everyone refers to it by the same name, student-faculty ratio, there's little commonality in what it actually means. So if one city reports a student-faculty ratio in their public schools, it might have little connection or little relationship to what another city might use for what they call exactly the same thing. And so trying to compare these two cities with respect to student-faculty ratio is hopeless if you have no commonality. Rules and axioms can make a great deal of difference in terms of making this interoperable and making this data just understandable. So what you're talking about. Moving on to slide 16, this is actually, I just mentioned Eric Chen's talk there, but actually there's many other examples of this. One way to develop your ontology is to make it more of a framework rather than a complete ontology, and you include extension points within your framework so that you make it easier to reuse your ontology. So you basically plan to have it be reused. So Eric developed this, or Eric and his colleagues developed this framework for observation and decision making that he called CARE. And in this framework, he identified different kind of points where you could insert your ontology. So it's more of a skeleton for a an ontology rather than a full ontology. He identified different kinds of data, different kinds of knowledge, and proposed that you would insert into his framework your ontology according to the purpose and the role that it plays within the process of observation and decision making. Malcolm Chisholm was another one who mentioned an example of this kind of thing where he talked about governance and how, you know, we need a framework for data quality. So that's yet another example of building a building with extension points. Dan Brickley also had a vocabulary pipeline that he mentioned in his talk about how one could take other vocabularies, other ontologies, and insert them into the schema.org framework via extension points. So that's yet another example how reuse could be facilitated using this kind of use case. Moving on to slide 17. This is kind of related to others. It's important to involve communities in the in your ontology. They're the ones who are going to be the users, and so you would really like to have them be involved as early as possible. And it's important that they be involved even if they do not necessarily contribute to the ontology. So Ruth Durer, of course, had an example where different communities were contributing, as well as communities that were just involved and were the users then ultimately of these of the ontology that was being developed for CIs. Yet another example, of course, in a much larger scale, is was Dan Brickley's talk when he spoke about involving all the various communities and companies that are involved with developing tools and content for the web. So that's another example where we should definitely involve communities in these efforts. Moving on to slide 18, the governance framework. This use case is one where we use relatively deep inference involving axioms and rules to ensure data quality. One of the examples of this was the OOR initiative from Ontology Summit 2008, so 6 years ago now, emphasized as one aspect of it the governance and business rules for ensuring quality of ontologies. Another example, of course, is the Malcolm Chisholm talk where he explicitly discussed the important characteristics of governance frameworks for ontologies. Slide 19, I call this use case bridge axioms. We can use bridge axioms both at the data and metadata levels to bridge the gap between the semantics of data from different sources. This is, of course, what InterIOP is all about. in the talks by Mark Fox and Rosario Aceda Sosa, they discussed how they used this kind of technique in their work on smart cities. And of course also Nathan Wilson, Nathan Wilson also had some interesting aspects of this. He found that in an ontology, especially ontologies that have occurred in biology, the terminology, okay, so the taxonomy, the ontology, actually varies over time. That's within the same, we're talking about within the same ontology. There's a, you understand the world differently over time. So this can lead to a problem because literature and data from earlier times use the older terminology. So the only way you can understand this data from perhaps even a few years back is to have some kind of bridge axiom or rules that allow you to relate the terminology of the past with the terminology of the present. So it's an issue not just between different sources, but in fact within the same ontology to deal with this bridging problem. Now on slide 20, I just mentioned a number of other use cases. I actually already talked about vocabulary pipeline within the context of ontology development with extension points. But you could regard that as being a use case on its own, how one has a definite workflow pipeline for incorporating vocabularies. Then pattern matching is another one. This is the terminology can be complex, as we see. There may be different ways of saying the same thing, and it would be good to map those different ways to the same URI. But as Nathan Wilson pointed out, there can also be very different meanings for the same name. So it would be a little bit risky to fasten on, say, just one URI for a species only to discover that you're really talking about two different species. And suddenly the links to that URI, if not really being broken, are semantically broken, since any link that refers to these two species using a single URI is no longer meaningful. It's no longer the case that it's a single species. So so one has to be concerned, in effect, about versions of ontologies and therefore versioning of such resource names. Then finally, there was information ecosystem that was mentioned by Seda Sosa. The idea is to have a whole ecosystem of tools, techniques, and concepts throughout the entire data processing enterprise. And that was also something that was brought up by Philip Bourne, who envisioned this sort of information ecosystem for the biomedical research and education communities. So it seems like this is something that should also be addressed, and that the ontology community certainly can be a good part of this, an important part of it, actually. Then slide 21, there are many challenges, of course. As I've already said, there's little collaboration now between the communities, but I have suggested a number of use cases for how we can hopefully start to deal with this problem and improve the level of collaboration. The unfortunate focus on volume and velocity by big data and data science in general, with the assumption that somebody else is going to handle variety, that's not our problem. There's, of course, this big issue that Philip Bourne also mentioned, which is tool incompatibility. You tend to have so many silos, ways of doing things, but there is no ecosystem that allows all of these to be used in a compatible, interoperable way. The last one was mentioned. We didn't actually deal too much with this in the in our track was the hybrid reasoning gap, perhaps in a later in some later track or a summit, we can come back to this. The last slide is just some references. So thank you very much, and perhaps we can have some questions.
Okay, we have about 5 to 10 minutes, depending on how long you want. Any questions here? Yeah, Todd.
Ken, I posted the question on the chat room, but I'll ask it again. It occurred to me when we're talking about provenance, and this also relates to what Philip Bourne was talking about in terms of his research object, in terms of trying to, say, describe where data came from, and the situation I have in mind is some of the detectors that they have at CERN for their particle experiments, in trying to describe to some other user where this data came from, how much detail do you really have to go into? And more specifically in the context of ontologies, how much of that domain knowledge of how the data is created may be necessary to provide the appropriate, what we're calling, provenance to allow the reuse of that data, or even the discovery thereof?
Well, generally speaking, more the better, I suppose, but the purpose of the data can certainly be very important for discovering it, for finding it, of course. I mean, without some idea of why it was created, why would you even look at it? So that's pretty essential. And of course, understanding how it was created is also very important for things like being able to use the data even. It's a subtle thing. I mean, at the kind of informally at the review panel, I was talking to someone about the image processing, and I think people might naively think that when you have a camera, some sort of, all it's doing basically is recording the raw data from the from whatever you're looking at, right? Each pixel is just whatever photons you got from that particular place in the image. That's absolutely not true. These cameras actually do a lot of processing on the data, and very often that processing is proprietary. And so you really sometimes don't know actually what kind of processing went on in something as simple as just the pixel in an image. And if you then subsequently wish to do some processing with that image or to use that image with other images, also presumably of the same thing, lacking this knowledge of how that data was processed might make anything you do with that data problematic at best and perhaps completely wrong at worst. Okay, does that help a little, Todd?
Sort of. That then leaves open the question of how much effort you're going to go into to describe how the data was created. So the example you gave is perfect, because you can also talk about the technology of the sensor that was used and the way they do masking of different frequency bands and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. So I guess I would suspect the same scenario occurs in many other natural science experiments where the mechanism that you're using or the mechanisms and how they were implemented and the time of day, the air pressure, blah, 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 all could become critical if your use of the data is very sensitive or needs to be very specific.
So I guess then the question for the research community is, how much work, extra work do you want to do?
Well, it may not be necessary to do a lot of extra work if the tools that were available took care of providing this already.
We mean tools that you're using in your experiments in the first place? If they were sufficiently self-explanatory?
If the tools already provided this, I mean, when you take a picture, you don't have to then proceed to spend a great deal of time analyzing what it was that you did to the picture.
Maybe you should take it offline a little bit here in terms of interest.
The camera should already do this for you.
Yeah, so any other questions here? Go ahead.
More questions?
I think you have to switch on the...
Oh, thank you, sorry. It's late. Beth to Julian from Booz Allen. I had a question. I'm looking for best practices for versioning. You talk about versioning. I have some need for pulling together an ontology from other ontologies, and that's an issue for me, is a term can change in one and not the other, and I need to follow that. Do you have any examples of best practices for versioning? Anybody?
It's a good question, and I guess
say a prayer.
That is indeed, a really good
question. I mean, there's a lot of work done in the databases on versioning and things like that, so
right,
maybe you can
right.
get some.
There's some in the database community. There's theoretical work that exists for this. The modularity work also deals with the versioning issues. So there are a number of sources for how one can deal with versioning, but I don't know that there's a single real good understanding of how one should deal with it.
In fact, if you go back about 20 years ago on the object-oriented database development, mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of work done on versioning, like Stan Zdenek at Brown University and folks like that. They've published a number of papers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's see. Beth, you got to switch that off if you understand. Okay, now, any more questions here before we go to the next session? I guess not. So, pardon? There are a couple of changes. I guess, Tim, you want to talk about that? I mean, Tim, you're taking over this session, so you're going to talk about the changes.
And also, because you might want to talk about the front page at 6:30, I don't know if everyone put in there, the total force, everything.
Okay, yeah. All right. So, Ram reminded me to remind everybody that there will be a group dinner tonight at 6:30, and it's just in this building in the restaurant down on the ground floor, the last page. We have a doodle poll where you can register your attendance.
Front page.
Sorry. Whatever. It's got page in there somewhere. So, if you haven't put your name on the poll indicating you wanted to come anyway. You know, we've got enough space. All right, so this is... This next session is on community resources, outreach, website, program management, and production discussions. Now, it involves tracks G, R, and M, and there will be a presentation from track G.
Is it separate?
Hmm? Amanda, we'll do it locally?
Right, yes.
Okay. Do you have slides, Amanda?
Not for track
G. Okay, well, that's good. We don't need slides for everything. Okay. Okay, so why don't you come on up and do that, and then we'll follow that with a report from Track R, and you'll do that also, a part of that, and then we'll have a couple of remote presentations. No, Peter, you're going to do one here locally, and we have a remote presentation, and then finally a remote presentation on Track M.
Okay, my presentation on the community library aspect of Track G is going to be short and sweet. For the last several years for the Ontology Summit, I've set up a group library on Zotero.org, and the nature of the experiment has changed a bit each year with lessons learned. The first year, the first lesson was that one person cannot possibly maintain that library with all of the references generated from the entire, across the, all the months of the summit. Although, if you look on Zotero under Ontology Summit 2012, you'll see hundreds of references did make it in there, but it needs to be a collaboratively done thing. This year, some of the same applies to last year. This year, put that lesson to use in actually setting up the library and then handing over the population of it to the community at large, and that did not work. This has everything to do with some things that were brought up earlier in relationship to technologies in general, including ontologies, in that use of it takes time to do this, right? You have to learn a new thing again, how to put information. It's relatively simple once you use it, but you still have to do it. And everybody is busy, you know, with plenty of other stuff anyway, and there's not that much incentive. So this is a point Steve Ray brought up. It's under-incentivized, so it didn't get populated. And I think there's also another lesson in there that has to do with the utility of it. Zotero, like so many things, you can folder what resources you put in there, and you can tag them, but the tags are just tags. They're not, for example, organized into an ontology, so you can't sort through them in a meaningful way. That may or may not affect its usability for a group like this. I didn't do the data collection to find out if that was an obstacle, but that's the end for that particular experiment.
Now I would like to introduce Amanda. We'll talk about the next thing on the agenda, which is. Have some slides.
More positive things to say about outreach. So in order to try and improve our ability to reach people who are not always and every year and familiarly involved in the Ontology Summit, I set up a couple of social media accounts, or started them going with Peter's help, and one on Google Plus and one on Twitter. Now I have the first slide here is a snapshot. It's long and snapshot oddly, but essentially. With both accounts, the primary activity was to rebroadcast announcements about events coming up and reminders about them and more information about the content and try and reach people who weren't already being reached by summit emails and so forth. One thing I'd like you to notice on this Ontology Summit page, it's got 67 followers, but almost 5,000 views. Okay, there's not a huge number of posts. But what did happen is that these posts were shared, but they were made both public and shared to identified members of the semantic technology community, big data technology, SEMweb, et cetera, as well as ontology. And by identified, I just mean that I knew about them from them being in other people's circles that they've created and shared in those technology communities. And that seemed to actually be effective, to get views on those announcements from people who were not in there already. Now, whether that played out into attendance, I don't know. Right? But there's that. The Twitter account, Ontology Summit, let's see, what do I want to say about that? Well, you can see from this is just a snapshot of its profile. You can see from the notifications that it's actually fairly interactive. People read, retweet, very occasionally tweet direct to it. also I created some lists under there, which I publicized at the beginning, but, you know, need republicizing now. Pretty much everybody that followed the account, if they evaluated their Twitter profile to see if they were real or a bot or something, if they were real and seemed to be actually a member of one of these communities or a relevant organization, they got added to these lists. So those are lists of interest, I think, to the community generally, in that if you – and they're subscribable. So you can follow these lists. These are public lists that other people on Twitter can follow. So if you follow them, you will suddenly see, you know, much activity from your fellows there. Now, finally, just a little bit of analysis that was freely available through Hootsuite, which just happens to be the tool that I use for social media management. We can see that the growth of interest steadily grew as the summit went on. Under follower growth, that was slide 5, sorry, I haven't been saying it. And it also provides a list of what tweets were most popular and how many clicks they got or how many retweets. And the hackathon-related tweets got a lot of action. And actually, let me just that's the last slide, but let me just say something about the hashtags here, because I know unlike the communities we wanted to reach, this is not a particularly tweetful community, folks may not understand what the hashtags do. There are a couple of different ways of seeing a tweet if you're a Twitter user or follower, right? One is somebody you follow tweeted it, and it shows up in your stream. Another is it's got a hashtag on it for a topic that you pay attention to. You may have an existing search in your tools that tracks it. So there are people who follow Semantic Web or SemWeb all the time, linked to data or linked open data all the time, big data all the time. Right? They see those things. So part of the point of this was we need more involvement for those communities. So we make these tweets. It doesn't only get in front of the people who are, who are in the room already or getting emails already. It also gets in front of people who are following those topics. And I think that worked because we occasionally got actually responses back from people who are not in this room and who are in those other communities. What it didn't get, and this is going to be my last comment, what it didn't get is the level of direct and serious and regular involvement we would have liked to see. It didn't pull that many people into the room. It pulled some people in, but not what we'd have liked to see. And I think that has to do with something that has been mentioned, I think, a couple of times already. There are some walls between the traditional ontology community and especially Semantic Web and linked data. And just sharing information isn't enough to get past that, right? More work to be done. And that's a longer discussion than 6 minutes or whatever. So, but that's it.
Thank you, Mindy. Although I have to say, I think the really effective thing would be to learn how to write titles for tweets and posts that are link bait. You know, top 10 reasons why your ontology failed.
there's also a well-known fact that tweets with pictures are much, much more effective, but we didn't really have pictures to tweet. We didn't even have an icon. So.
Okay, Marcella, are you online? Marcella Baghetti?
Star 7?
Peter, is do you think you see her there?
Yes, I'm unmuting her.
Marcella, if you can hear us, could you unmute your...
I've unmuted her.
Okay.
Can you test your voice, Marcella?
Hello? Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Okay. Can I begin my presentation?
Yes. Please let us know what slide you're moving to when you move, want to move to a new slide.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. This year, I play the role of champion of the Ontology Summit 2014 website development team, which in fact is a very little team. I'm the only member. The aim of this presentation is to introduce a brief report of the mission of the team and the executed activities during this 3 months. Next slide, please. Slide number 2.
Yes.
One thing many of you can be asking is why we need another website if we have the Ontolog Wiki. The Ontolog Wiki stores all contributions and serves as a dynamic knowledge repository of the summit activities. However, some people may get lost with the great volume of information that a wiki page contains. Moreover, its look and feel is not very attractive. Therefore, since the Ontology Summit 2012, each year a parallel public-facing website has been developed. The idea has been to have a website summarizing the most important information related to the Ontology Summit activities. This is a huge effort in and of itself, but it is only a transition task. There are a group of people working in the migration of Ontolog Wiki to a new semantic wiki platform. The public-facing website development is a requirement until the migration of Ontolog Wiki to Ontolog Partner Semantic Media Wiki is complete. Slide number 3, please.
Yes.
The mission of the team is to deploy a public-facing and visually simplified website that will provide access to the Ontology communique, information about summit tracks and other activities, as well as links to their Ontolog Wiki pages, a complete list of the weekly conferences presenting their topics and invited panelists, a calendar of the summit events showing weekly sessions, symposium, and hackathon activities, links to social media like Twitter and Google Plus, a sponsor acknowledgement page, information about the group of people that support Ontology Summit activities, as well as other resources like recommended readings, archive of discussion list emails, Ontolog Wiki, etc. Next slide, please.
Okay.
To reach this mission with plans and activities. The first thing to do was to decide about website structure and style. In this sense, we've evaluated 3 choices. The first one, to reuse last year's website, adding some new features like a Google Calendar, links to social media, page with information about sponsor and some minor style changes. The second alternative was to maintain the structure and change the style completely. New color, fonts, and page layout. And finally, the last one was to start from scratch, designing a new website structure and style. Because the website had to be published quickly, the best choice was the first one. Reuse the last year website with some minor style changes and some new additions. Once this decision has been taken, the development of the pages starts. When the most important pages had been finished, the website was published. Next slide, please.
Okay.
Some other activities are required to be done after the publication of the website. We publish news and events, information about hackathon activities, as well as symposium registration call, among other topics. The new features like Google Calendar and the access to social media were also incorporated after the initial publication of the website. The only task that remains to do is to update the site with the final version of this year's communique. Next slide, please. Finally, I want to show you a snapshot of the main page of the Ontology Summit 2014 website. If you have the opportunity to access to the link that is shown in the slide, you'll be able to see the result of the show. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, thank you, Marcella. Now, Peter's going to give a brief presentation also on the website.
Right. I just got this job like this afternoon, so it's not going to have slides. Let me see. And I pasted a few links over to the chat room. So to pick up from where we left off, let's see. Oh. Okay. 2000. Oops, I need a keyboard.
You want it? Okay.
Yes, as Marcella was mentioning, hopefully the pretty website was transitional because we want the wiki to eventually be pretty. So we started out, I mean, getting the same graphics in place. This is the symposium page with the same content coming from the Ontolog wiki, but refactored automatically. The migration was done, I guess, last night to something that looks like this. So one thing that the team, which essentially included Ken Buklowski and Tejas Parikh, who used to be Ken's student, now working for IBM, and Simon Sparrow and myself, we had done a few things. One of the things that got resolved was a different skin or different banner, at least at this point, when we categorized the different pages. So, I mean, instead of one single site banner across all the pages, now we have, like, 2014 Ontology Summit. We have the 2014 graphics. This was the 2013 graphics. And if we go to 2012 Summit page. They're all on the same wiki. Then we'll have the different. It's not loading. So you can recall from before. And, of course, knowing the semantic wiki, I mean, you can categorize and put attributes against various information in the wiki. And so with that, the opportunities are huge. But obviously someone will have to work on it. So that's the first thing that went through. Another interesting idea was, of course, in how we will be doing the Ontolog wiki in general, which we call the Ontolog PSMW, Purple Semantic Media Wiki, and it's still in the sandbox here, but if we go to tests, there are several tests that are already implemented, one of which is the inclusion of a calendar. I think, I mean, way back at the beginning, Dan Brickley was saying, I mean, why can't I just move the calendar item into my personal calendar. Actually, now you can. I mean, both from Marcella's website as well as from the Ontolog PSMW website. Next test item was the inclusion or framing of Google Documents. So while the team was developing the Ontology Summit draft, the Ontology Summit 2014 communique draft, actually that draft and the evolving version of it had always been available here. A third thing that Simon, I mean, these three things are sort of Simon's plans and which he will was hoping to do maybe in the future. The other thing is called Discuss. Discuss is somewhat like, I don't know how many people would know Discuss, is you post an article or a blog, and then people would have comments below, and then you capture those. So that's the Discuss extension, which is now also available on the Ontolog PSMW with Simon and Tejas Parikh sort of putting time into making that happen. So the last thing I might want to demo is, given that we have sort of, let's say, a generic Ontolog banner, we could also have customized banner. So different people will have to send us different things, like this one, Open Ontology Repository. I mean, if you have a logo like IAOA, we could sort of overlay the IAOA logo onto one of the banners, and then within the same wiki, we can actually host different communities, and they will all have a slightly different look and feel. So, end of demo.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you. That really looks exciting. It really looks nice. Yeah. So we have one more session before Peter will come back again and give some remarks about the whole enterprise we're engaged in. So the last session is a remote one, and it is a report from Track M, which will be given by Christy Kapp. Christy, are you there?
Yes.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes. I'm bringing up the slides right now, and I'll advance them whenever you give me a signal that you're moving to a new slide. So please begin.
Okay, great.
Begin.
All right. What we're talking about is the program management aspect to the Ontology Summit. You can advance to slide 2. The objective for Team M, which is the program management team, is to really focus on the process of moving the summit along through its various stages. So we do things like planning, supporting the overall planning and organization. We help provide infrastructure and other things that are needed, work on logistical issues, again, focus on process, and then coordinate the production of the program. One of the things that's unique to this group is that the quality that's dedicated to making sure that the artifacts produced are of, you know, almost research quality. So we help that process along. You could move to slide 3. Here is the OODA loop for the Ontology Summit process. We are now in the 2014 Ontology Summit Symposium. After this, there's a post-mortem that happens in May. Then there's a series of months where groups brainstorm. Then in the fall through December, there is some pretty serious planning that happens with the co-organizers. The theme gets selected, the new organizing committee is created, and Team M is supporting that whole process. In January, the summit launches. And it goes through April and then concludes again with the symposium where the communique gets created and published. Actually, it starts being created before that. If you could go to slide 4. This slide's really showing some of the work, not all of the work, but some of the work that the summer general co-chairs do. They do work with the reps from the co-organizers. They help, actually they do set direction for the summit. They're going to confirm the theme, the objective, the scope. They do a look back with what's happening here. They look at what's happening out there and then decide where to go. They look again at the process. And again, TMM's role through all of this is just supporting them in their work. The other thing that this group does is they act as the co-lead editors for the summit communique. Go to slide 5, please. So this is what happens during the organization and planning part of the loop. The representatives from all the co-organizers confer to initialize the new summit program and set the direction. They're going to form the new organizing committee. They always need new representatives, new volunteers. Team M could use some more volunteers for next year. I'm going to put the plug out there now. They organize and facilitate the team and the work structure, so technical tracks, support tracks, co-champions. We're behind the scenes helping with that. The summit program content, which is 3 to 4 months of focused activities working on the content, defining what the content will be. And then in January, coordinating the summit launch event. So throughout this process, everybody meets regularly to track and assess what's going on and make sure that quality is being adhered to. Another really important part to this whole process is the conformance to the openness policy. This whole collaboration would not work if people weren't sharing, so this is very important. Go to slide 6, please. So this is actually where I came into the process this year. My experience begins here. So during the actual beginning of the summit process in January, there's two things going on simultaneously. One is that the organizing committee is meeting weekly along with the presentations happening weekly. So the planning is happening all along while the presentations are also happening. So Team M supports both groups. The first group is supporting the organizing committee, and that is really making sure that everybody knows when the meetings are, helping prepare agendas, sending out announcements, reminders, links to results of meetings, and then facilitating the actual meeting. Now, specific tasks are things like facilitating and recording the audio conferences. And we've talked a lot today about what slide are you on. That's some of the things that we do, is ask that question and make sure that there's coordination between what people are talking about and what's happening on the chat, and then what we need later to be able to edit all these artifacts. So editing chat transcripts, that's really fun. I'll talk about that a little more in the next slide. But we do a little bit of editing, slight amount of reorganization, and then action items. When it's the organizing committee, we want to make sure that we're capturing who needs to do what next. Then there's some processing to the audio. So once the recording's made of the audio, we want to make sure that it's compressed so that when people download it, it's not too huge. And then editing of things that might happen during an audio conference, like if somebody's dog barks in the background or things like that. We want to take that out. And then collecting analytics. So if you could move to the next slide, slide 7. Okay, so for the virtual events, it's kind of similar to what we do with the organizing committee support. Again, communication tasks, staying on top of all the preparation and the progress. There's a little bit more with slide preparation because we want to make sure we get the slides from the speakers. They need to be named so that they're standard. And if they're not already in PDF format, we convert it, tag it with metadata, and we make sure that the slides have numbers, again, so that when people are referring to numbers when they're talking on the audio, you can find it on the slides. Now, this is where it gets kind of fun, because when the actual sessions are happening, there's a chat going on at the same time, and each week there are probably three presentations. The first presentation takes about, you know, everybody's about half an hour, maybe more, and nobody chats for a little while, and then all of a sudden everybody starts to chat, and they talk, and there's a lot of good dialogue. So you have people talking on the audio, and then you have people chatting on the chat. The next thing that happens is the next person starts speaking, but the people that were talking about the thing from the first presentation keep going. And then the people who are more interested in the next presentation, they start chatting. So now you have interleaved themes in the chat from the first talk and the second talk. And then it kind of keeps going like that until the end, where by the time you have Q&A, everybody's talking about all of the presentations. So some of the light editing that we do is to put that back in order so that if another person comes along in 3 months or 6 months and wants to read it, they can see how that all works together. So when you look at the process chat transcripts, you might notice that the times can be interesting. And that's just because of what's happening with people collaborating. And let's see, we also do conference audio processing. For this, we do, again, compression, a little bit of editing, tagging with metadata, and then something that I have not experienced yet, which is publishing the audio archive to a podcast, so to be resumed. Now, the next slide, slide 8. So after symposium, symposium is a little bit different. There's not quite as much happening on the chat, but there's a lot of good work. So for the symposium production, Team M works very closely with the host personnel, whoever that may be, and also with the co-chairs. Stay on top of the preparation and the progress, again, coordinating logistics, sending things out in the email, proceedings, all of those kind of coordination tasks. And then after the symposium is over, there's post-processing again, which is to process the audio recording. And we do this a little differently. These get separated into individual presentations and tagged with metadata. And then the chat transcripts get processed and added to the wiki also. So that is all I have for this. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Question, yes.
Steve Ray, CMU. Christy, that really got me starting to think how you sort of laid it out so systematically. Makes me think whether we have considered automating parts of it or automating with a combination of sort of workflow tools plus Mechanical Turk to do some of the disambiguation of the interleaved chat. Seems like you could really streamline this whole process. Have you thought about that?
That's funny you mentioned the streamlining of the chat. One of the things is that you need to have some amount of domain knowledge to be able to reorder them. So you have to know what the people are saying. And I've been learning a lot, so I did not really help much with this at the beginning. I got able to do it, I don't know, probably two-thirds of the way through, but Peter did keep doing most of that work. I'm not sure that Mechanical Turk skill sets could do it, but I think anybody on the in the community could do it. So perhaps it could be taught and coached over, I would say, the next couple of months, and then additional people could help.
Peter?
Yeah, I really want to thank Christy for capturing and documenting the entire process. And this was something I believe was Matthew or someone suggested very early in the organizing committee because we don't really, I mean, up to this point before Christy captured it, we don't really have a captured process. Most of the stuff was in my head.
It was in your head, Peter. It was in your head.
Yeah. So now it's in the open.
Okay, thank you very much. The final session today will be some remarks from Peter on the Ontology Summit operation in perspective.
Okay.
maybe you can help. Okay, next slide. Does it work? Wait.
You're actually controlling the screen.
I guess we will just do slides by my calling out slide numbers, no shared screen. So I asked the chairs to give me a few minutes to speak because I wanted to announce my retirement and maybe take a chance in these few minutes to share a few stories that I've learned in the past 9 ontology summits, about 15 years of work with the ontology community, and over 4 decades of work with information systems. And of course, the most important part is that I wanted to thank everyone and say goodbye here. So going to the next slide, the very beginning of the ontology summit, it actually started with at least the version that I have been involved, started in 2006 when we had the Upper Ontology Summit. At that time, 4 people got this started: Pat Cassidy, Leo Oberst, Steve Ray, and myself. And 3 of us were ontolog, and of course Steve straddled both communities. And NIST was kind enough to host us. At that time, it was still a 2-day conference. I mean, it's not as elaborate as this. I'll go into that a little more. So we had 2 co-organizers that year. And the great thing was all the stewards of open upper ontologies were represented, I mean, practically. Barry Smith from Buffalo, Doug Leonard was there from Psych, Nicola Guarino was there representing Dolce, and Aldo Ganjami was on the phone representing Dolce DNS, John Bateman representing the GUM model, Global Upper Model. At that time, actually, he wasn't even called GUM. I think the acronym came after 2006. Matthew West was there representing ISO 15926. Michael Gruninger, if you can see him in that picture, a lot younger than he is now, representing PSL. And Adam Peace was there representing Sumo. It was really a big thing. And the motivation was, I mean, why did we want all the upper ontology people there? Because upper ontologies was like a religion. Everybody believes they have the right religion, and everybody else was wrong. And we come to the recognition that, I mean, if we keep on thinking that, we'll never get anywhere. So that whole group came together. Actually, quite a few people from that year is still in this room.
I still remember, like, Michael Ushold was there, of course, Leo driving it, and so on. And we realized we were part of the problem, that that needs to get resolved. And we did. And one of the things that also got us started was sort of drafting a joint communique. So the first year we had this work process called a joint communique. Probably was a Steve Ray concoction. And that tradition sort of went forward, although, I mean, it was like two pages the first year, and it keeps growing. And Nicola Guarino was there, and he said, ah, this is great, but this is not the first one. 8 years ago, some rich guy in Germany actually brought all the top ontologists of the world together in Heidelberg. That was, I think, the week after they had the first voice, the Formal Ontology and Information Systems Conference in if it's Nicola, probably in Trento or somewhere in Italy. And this whole group of people were there in Heidelberg. And Nicola was saying, sadly enough, they all left, still fighting each other. So nothing really went on, I mean, for another 8 years until we got together at the 2006 Upper Ontology Summit at NIST. So NIST is sort of the organization that got us all started. So going on to the next slide, we continue to innovate and sort of fast forward 9 seasons after we saw the process that Christy just presented. Throughout these 9 years, we chose very clever themes. I mean, either the co-chairs or the co-organizers picked the theme that really would move the community forward every year. And every year, it's not just a 3 or 4 month event, but something that has a very long tail. Ontology-based standards still goes on. Open ontology repositories still moves on. Of course, we still argue what is an ontology. That's a regular topic. But over the years, more co-organizers, more organizing team members, more contributors, more participants, and we're reaching out to more people. The organizing process innovation were steady as well. We moved from a 2-day conference to this year a 4-month series of both virtual and on-site events with like 15 virtual sessions, 6 hackathons, and a community library, a ontology repository, a pretty website, and an ugly website, and so on. And we use an organization model structure which is fairly unique to network. Bob Johansson and Rob Swigart wrote in 1996, I believe, sort of coining this term called a fishnet organization. So if you look at an organization like the fishnet, it's something that you can pick up and form a temporary hierarchy. So, I mean, we have a community, everyone is equal, but temporarily we form a hierarchy. We've got leaders, we've got champions, we've got a sort of temporary structure to execute a task, and when the task is over, the organization disbands. So that's quite novel. I mean, people talk about hierarchical structure, organization, matrix organization. We are neither. We're essentially a fishnet organization. And I believe we established a model where on what a broader networked community of practice might accomplish. particularly when it includes a lot of very smart people. Very smart people tend not to work with one another very well, and the Ontology Summit has so far proved that wrong. I mean, if we organize it properly, it will actually be good. So, of course, if I say I'm retiring, I'm probably to be pretty old. I mean, I'm not the oldest in the room, but I'm old enough. I mean, and I have to say I've been blessed and very, very lucky. Blessed in the sense that things that I've worked on constantly become sort of much more successful. Not because of me, but I mean, it's just the nature of the people that I run into. I mean, even my college roommate ended up being the MIT math department chair. Of course, when we were college roommates, we don't know it. I was looking up Tim Finan, and I found out that we probably overlapped at MIT, because when I was at RLE, and we walk around, and Terry Winogrand's Blocks World was actually in the hallway. You probably remember that. And like 20 years later, I ended up working with Terry and mounted the Doug Engelbart Colloquium at Stanford. So, I mean, all these things come back, and, I mean, people like Andy Shane, who's Ontolog community, became like NASA CTO, or of course, I mean, somebody like George, I mean, getting the top job in information systems R&D in the country and blessing us. So I've contributed some time. I mean, of course, a lot of people did. I did some too. I did some work. I actually did put in some money. I mean, people probably wouldn't realize how much it costs to stand up an infrastructure that could sustain or that could host this kind of work. When I first met Mark Musin, Mark asked, "Who's funding you?" I said, "Nobody, maybe my family." And he said, "Okay, let's work together." And so we did, and I come from sort of fairly different background from most people. I came from manufacturing, so production means a lot more to me than most researchers. So most of our infrastructure are triple redundant, is run on a tier one data center, and so on, and. But most importantly, I think I put in a lot of passion, and that was